address, which is among the annual report, which is one of those statutory obligations that the department, police, and Harris Staples and other entities, and that department itself uses that instrument as an exercise, an opportunity for the exercise of oversight. So it was with some concern that I looked up a document on my emails telling us in Parliament or referring to the declining influence of Parliament, written by Teddy Mabunga, and of course he interviews multi-party representatives here, including our own chief of office, members of the official opposition. And it is of concern to me that civil society in South Africa would see Parliament as a toothless bulldog. I can assure you that this particular committee have all their teeth, and we intend to exercise that so that South Africans, all the people of South Africa, can enjoy their rights, exercise their responsibilities, and enjoy the freedoms under the Constitution that we have. That is our job, and we will do that. But we also, I don't think we expect to conduct interrogation. That's a very different thing from engaging with people who've been put in a position to perform certain functions. So we are going to be dealing with that in a very robust manner this morning. I know the practice has been in the second term in Parliament to allow for people to show off their IT skills and indicate that they may be ready to produce films, but that's not how we do things here. We're interested in the facts. The fact that you may have a PowerPoint up here, that's great. It's just a little extra cosmetic exercise. What we want here are the facts. You're not going to be running the show. You're not going to be having an hour and a half. And I understand you don't want this. I understand you're also interested in just engaging. So the committee secretary tells me in the room that he's allocated the 20 minutes. So the question for me, for you now, is whether or not you can produce as a presentation in 20 minutes. And I need that from you now.
Admittedly, I did prepare a longer presentation, but I can't do it in 20 minutes.
If you can do that, and then what we will do is through the questions, we will spend a lot longer, another hour, you see, in the engagement. And where some of the questions refer to what you may not have shown us, then you might see it. You have done, I think you've done some very good work as a commission, but it's not the hard aspect, but let's also see evidence of that, all right? On the committee side, please turn off your cell phone. I'm introducing a rule covered by Parliament that your cell phones will be confiscated if I hear them. So anyone who's expecting a call, please leave at that time. I will be handing over the chair to someone, probably round about 11, I understand, or pop up 11, because I have an important meeting regarding the programming of this committee, which I'll have to engage in for 10, 15 minutes, and then I will return. And I'll be handing over to the whip of this committee, the Honourable Chris Ntsubi. Now, on that note, I want to just find out from the committee secretary, so to avoid a repetition of yesterday, are there any members of the public with us this morning that are sitting on either side of me, other than the parliamentary PNG? Yep. Two journalists. Right at the back. Good. Please don't anyone who walks in after this, Mr. Herman, is to take a seat right at the back. Thank you. All right, so I'd like to welcome you, Ms. Manoyan, for being with us here, and also we did enjoy your launch last night. Thank you very much. And it's going to be immediately over to yourself.
Chairperson, thank you very much, honourable members. Chairperson, just a point of clarification is that both Mr. Manoam and I will give him a presentation for 20 minutes each. Is that right? Well, thank you. I've organized this presentation to kind of follow pretty much the format in our annual report. And in the annual report, you see that what we've done is we've looked at particular sectors in the first section, and then in the second section, we've reported on the work of each of the divisions within the Competition Commission. One of the difficulties in getting a presentation like this is that it's at least 6 months since the end period of this report, so I might have to kind of update people beyond the period of the report in the course of this presentation. I think that I'm going to flip the first slide, and this is essentially about the highlights of the commission that is covered in the commissioner's preface in the annual report. I think that it's important to say to start off with that most of the interesting work that we do in the commission has to do about cases. So, to get a real feel of the work we do and how we go about doing it, one has to look at each individual case and look at how we dealt with that case. And in a presentation like this, I might just make mention of them, but it's in detail of those cases that the bulk of and the most meaningful part of our work gets done. As you are all aware, we reported previously, the Commission has prioritized its work. It's looked at four broad sectors that we deal with in particular. The first part of the report looks at each of these four sectors. In the infrastructure and construction sector, which is an important sector that we prioritized 3 years ago, and a lot of our work is now beginning to come to fruition in this sector, there's been a lot of activity both in terms of dealing with cartel behavior and the extreme mergers that we dealt with as well, where some of these were prohibited. Very significantly, in December 2007, we initiated a case against the concrete piping cartel, which was referred to the tribunal earlier this year. We uncovered collusion in the concrete piped manholes and culverts markets. And earlier on, one of the companies involved in this cartel settled with us with a fine of 46 million rand. This is one of the instances where getting into the detail, one kind of understands how a cartel works. This cartel has been in operation since the 1970s. It has a particular way of operating in terms of how it agreed prices and fixed agreements and imposed it on the remaining members of the cartel. It's also a cartel that occurred over successive generations. So the people who were involved in the 1970s are no longer involved with a whole new lot of people. And it's interesting to how they pass on this cartel behavior from one generation of leadership in these firms to the next. The other important case regarding infrastructure and construction is regarding the plastic pipe cartel, which was referred to the tribunal in February this year. This case is interesting because we uncovered this cartel in a sense after we were notified of a merger, and in evaluating the merger, found that there was likely cartel behavior in this in this market and proceeded to do an investigation. This cartel also dates back at least 20 years, and in some of in this case, the commission is talking that the parties are keen to some of the parties are keen to settle with us and be engaging with them on that issue. Also, in the infrastructure and construction sector, there were two significant mergers. Of the four mergers that we prohibited in the last year, two of them came from the sector. One of them relating to wire products. This was when a bank was intended to buy steel reinforcing companies, and this merger would have resulted in high market shares and enhanced existing collusion in that industry, and the Commission prohibited this merger. The other merger we had related to asphalt, that's the stuff that one uses to build roads, this merger was also prohibited because it would have resulted in high market shares and it would have removed viable competitors in one of the regional markets. There are also very high barriers to entry in these markets. The second of our priority sectors is food, agro-processing, and forestry. And here we've had a fairly long-running case regarding the bread cartel. You'll recall that in this cartel, we had one of the four major members of the cartel apply for corporate leniency, which they got. And two of the members of the cartel, that's Tiger Brand, Corp settled with us. Food Corp in the year under review in the year under review relating to the annual report, type of that in the previous period. And in this period, we've also proceeded with the case against Pioneer, which has already been heard in the tribunal, and we're awaiting a decision of the tribunal on that matter. Linked to this and equally important is the Milling Cartel. And this is important because in some instances, some of the bread companies are vertically integrated into milling. We proceeded again with investigations around milling. Tiger Brand, for example, when they settled with us, settled on both bread and the milling. So they both Tiger and Premier are cooperating with the Commission investigation and in the prosecution of the remaining members of the cartel. But this has also given us an opportunity to understand better how cartels work across value chains. This matter still under investigation, hasn't been referred yet. There are two possible cartels here, one in flour and the other in maize meal. There's lots of regional arrangements between the parties, and that those regional arrangements collectively then kind of cement the cartel at the national level. So this is something that we're completing now in the investigative phase. We'll refer to the tribunal, and more information about the cartel will come out in public domain when that occurs. Also in food and agro-processing is our milk cartel. This is also a very long-standing case. First of tribunal in December 2006. It's a case involving collusion and abuse of dominance by the processors. All the major brand names are in there, and there's a lot of other very smaller companies involved as well. We've settled this matter with one of the companies in the financial year under review, that's Lonswith. Clover was given leniency for parts of the case, but not for other parts. And we have a big This is a very frustrating case for us in the Commission because it's taking fairly long to get to the merits of this matter, entirely because parties are taking legal technical points and preventing this matter from getting heard on the merits. So we've had like technical points around whether our summons were competent and done properly and whether we initiated the case properly. Essentially, we've got a year to complete an investigation, and the appointees argued in a case that went to competition appeal court, in other words, in fact, two judgments on this. They argued that we referred the case outside of that one-year period because they started counting the one-year period when somebody made a telephone call to the commission and spoke to the junior official, rather than we started counting it from the time that we officially got the document, the formal procedural document, and they lost the case in all of these courts, and now they're raising other technical matters to prevent these matters from getting to be heard on the merits. So you would see this, you know, some of these tribunal decisions in the case of Clover and Davis, but they would see the attainment of the Supreme Court of Appeal. And this is a frustrating process for us, but it's also something that occurs sometimes in this area where parties find that, you know, it's and I'm not suggesting this is entirely happening here with Clover, but parties feel that it's worth their while to prolong the case through legal proceedings, because in that period they are continuing this anti-competitive behavior, and perhaps the profits they're making through that kind of outweighs all the expense and trouble of taking all of these legal points. The third of our sectors that we intermediate industrial cover is essentially, you know, we're talking here about all the inputs that go into the manufacturing sector in South Africa, primarily chemicals, for which Sasol is involved, and steel, which metal is involved. And here, both of these companies and a number of products they produce are dominant players. And so we're dealing here with the dominant side of competition enforcement. In the case of Sasol, we've initiated cases regarding pipe gas against a whole range of companies, well, against four companies, including Sasol, and we've initiated the case of petroleum products, which involves all the major petrochemical companies, you know, Engen, BP, all the big names, and both of these cases are currently being investigated. In the case of the steel matter, you recall that kind of in the recent past this has been used where private litigation by Harmony Gold, the mining company, resulted in the tribunal making a finding against Mittal. That finding was then appealed to the Competition Appeal Court, and the Competition Appeal Court had a different take on how one arrived at that, a decision like that, and sent the matter back to the tribunal for reconsideration. And when it came back to the tribunal, before the tribunal could complete its reconsideration of that matter, the case was effectively withdrawn because Harmony settled the matter with Mittal. And of course, many people have kind of pointed out the problem with that sort of thing, where a party essentially gets away with it, and the commission itself was not a party to this case because it was brought privately. However, I should point out here that in this last financial year in particular, we have had a number of initiations against Mittal that cover pretty, these are new cases, that cover pretty much the same kinds of behaviors and issues that have been dealt with in the Harmony Mittal case. So we have investigations into tin plate pricing. Interestingly, a matter that was kind of referred to us by the DGI, this is about the cans that food goes into, and one of the arguments of the food processors is that one of the reasons why food prices are so high for canned food at least is because the cost of the steel can is so high. We're looking at that, and we're looking at other kinds of other cartel behavior in this market relating to long steel and relating to wire products as well. These are very difficult cases. They involve a difficult concept in competition law called around excessive pricing, case some guidance from both the tribunal and the competition appeal court on how to look at these matters. So those are essentially all the cases. The final of our four priority sectors is in financial services. Particularly looking at banking. You will all recall that the banking inquiry was concluded in June 2008. We released this report in December of that year. That report made 28 recommendations. Some of the more important ones require regulatory changes. You're all aware that the banks are regulated by the South African Reserve Bank under the auspices of Treasury, and in order to deal effectively with a lot of the problems, a lot of the recommendations that have been put out by the inquiry, we regulatory changes in the way in which the Reserve Bank regulates the banking sector have also to be made. So this was not an issue of us kind of initiating cases against the bank, because you know they would have a kind of ready-made answer that the regulation requires us to do this or that or the other, and it's the regulations that need to be changed here. So this is not something that the competition authority could do by itself. It requires the cooperation of the other regulatory bodies. And so what we did is we, together with National Treasury, with which we've had a fairly good working relationship on this matter, we set up a steering committee consisting of ourselves, Treasury, who's going to chair the steering committee, the DTI, and the Reserve Bank, and that steering committee has set up a number of different sub-working groups that will look at in detail different clusters of these recommendations, and the committee will then review these recommendations and make final plans about how they go about, how we go about implementing them. Just to look at the number of cases we've initiated in this financial year under review here, you'll see that if you look at the numbers of cases that's initiated by the Commission itself, you'll see that they kind of reflect quite heavily our priorities. Most of these cases are in the sectors that we've identified as priority sectors. Numbers of cases we've received in the financial year is shown in this graph. We have kind of seen fairly steady numbers of cases that we've initiated over the past 2 years or so. Except I think what the graph doesn't tell us is that over time, these cases are becoming more complicated and require higher levels of sophistication to deal with these matters. Everybody, I think, is aware that one of the most important things that has led to the Commission kind of seeing cases through to the end in a fairly kind of relatively short period of time is our corporate immunity policy. This, as you will be aware, is a policy that says the first member of a cartel that comes through the door and cooperates with the Commission and gives us information on the cartel will get immunity, in other words, will get indemnity from the prosecutor. In the financial year under consideration here, we amended the CRP to make it a more user-friendly and clearer document. We've kind of consulted with particular practitioners, lawyers, and other stakeholders, and looked at the international best practice on how one goes about running a corporate immunity policy. And what the amendments we've made now provide for is greater legal certainty, where the process is more clear and certain. We've introduced what we call a marker procedure, where you can put your name in, stand in a queue, to indicate to us that you're going to be providing us with this corporate leniency policy. So there's a queue of people, and if we don't accept the first leniency, we'll then consider the second one. So, because we don't automatically, everybody who applies apply to the unity doesn't automatically get it. You've got to meet certain criteria. You've got to give us, for example, information that we didn't previously know. Then there's we're looking at previously, in the previous policy, we didn't have, if you were a leader of the cartel, if you were the person who initiated the cartel, you were not, you couldn't apply for this corporate immunity, and that condition has now been taken away. Anybody can apply, any member of that cartel can apply for the immunity. We also provide in the new policy for oral submissions to be made. You can take down oral statements rather than submissions to be made in writing. And we've also reorganized ourselves in the commission to deal with this improperly, to deal with CRP properly, and one of our divisions is now responsible for doing that. This is a graph that shows the numbers of leniency applications we've received over a 6-month period in 2004, and you'll see that in the last period we have had a dramatic increase in the number of CS corporate leniency policy applications, and significantly a number of these are in the sectors that we've identified as priority sectors. Moving on to mergers, just some pictures of how the kinds of merger decisions we've taken. You'll see that the mergers we deal with run across all sectors of the economy. I think particularly in the manufacturing sector, we've seen a large number of mergers that we've kind of dealt with. And also significantly, I think the property sector, not only in the last year, but in the last few years, that we have taken up a fair number of our merger filings that we have to deal with. Important, there's a very significant thing that happened in the financial year under review is that we raised the merger threshold. Now, just to explain this a little, is that mergers, the Minister of Trade and Industry set out a threshold based on turnover assets of the merging firm. And if there's two thresholds that are set, the higher threshold, any firm where the merged combined turnover asset value is above the higher threshold is considered a large merger. If it's between the two thresholds, it's considered an intermediate merger, and below the lower threshold is a small merger. And of course, all large mergers have to compulsory notification to the authority for all large mergers before they can be consummated, and intermediate mergers. And the difference between the two is large mergers have to be ultimately considered by the tribunal before they are approved or otherwise, whereas intermediate mergers can be decided upon by the commission itself when they finally have once they appeal it, they appeal it to the tribunal. So in raising all of these thresholds, what it means is that there will be fewer notifications made to the authorities because the line cutting off is now raised, and this is the first time we've actually raised these thresholds since the start of the institution. Effectively, we've had one minor change in the first year of the institution, but since it's been about 8 years, we haven't changed it. So the raising of these thresholds kind of just adjusts for the value of money, essentially, and it also is important for us because it decreases our workload regarding mergers. And if you consider, for example, in this last financial year, we looked at over 400 mergers, and we only prohibited 4 of them, and have problems with another handful of them, you'll see that we are looking at a lot of transactions that we shouldn't be looking at. They're non-problematic transactions, and that will take up a lot of our financial period under review this morning. Another important, I think, picture and figure that is significant here is the amount that ministers of penalties that the competition authorities have levied in the sharp financial year. You see this is a very dramatic increase as well over time. In the last year, we've had a record of 331.5 million rand of fines and administrative penalties that were levied by the competition authorities. I think the significance here is that the amount of money, this amount of money is 331 million rand. It's at least twice the budget that the competition authority uses. So, in effect, we kind of contributed more to the fiscus than we used in that last year. I think also, just to look at what our major expenses, what are the things that are, where do we spend most of our money? And here's another slide now. Most of our money, in effect, is spent on human resources. But you'll see in this slide that what we're seeing over time, we're seeing that we are firstly litigating more cases. We're taking more cases to the courts, to the tribunal in the first instances and other courts, you know, insofar as there's appeals and that. So there are more cases, and we are spending considerably more amounts of money on litigation. Now, remember, what that means is, you know, we do the investigation, we prepare the case, we refer it to the tribunal, and when this goes to hearing, we have to hire a senior counsel from the marketplace at market-related fees. All of this is a very costly exercise, litigating these cases, which is why for an agency like us, corporate leniency policies make sense. You know, you'd much rather be settling cases than kind of litigating them, because they cost an enormous amount of money, they're very time-consuming, and they are uncertain. You know, there's always some clever lawyer that makes some clever point that you have thought about and tie up such cases in kind of litigation as we've seen in the Clover case. Then looking at some of our other divisions very quickly is we have a policy and research unit that kind of backs up the work of our core divisions, which is the enforcement division and emergency division, and they provide all sorts of kind of technical expertise to teams working on cases, to also prepare submissions for regulation matters, and they give seminars, they do some capacity building within the organization, and they kind of keep up to date on policy issues. We've also got a division in the commission that looks at our stakeholder relations, identify all the important stakeholders that we need to deal with and kind of deal with those people proactively approach us. We kind of provide guidance, we provide workshops, kind of capacity building sessions, training, all sorts of interactions with these bodies. I'm not going to get into the details that will come in the report. If you look at the staff of the commission, we've got here, if you count our graduate trainees, 172 staff as of 31st March 2009. You'll see that, you know, around half of that staff is your kind of technical expert, your lawyer or your economist working on a case. I think it goes without saying that for a kind of agency like ours, I know it's a cliche, but about for an agency like ours, you know, human resources are our biggest asset. That's what we need brains working on a case, sitting around, you know, doing the five of that half, three quarters of that half is spent on full-time salaries for staff. We also kind of pay particular attention to training in the organization. Not always training that you pay for outside people to do, but we kind of attention to, and I think succeeding very nicely to kind of create a kind of learning organization where people learn through the supervision process, through the way in which they are managed in the organization. And I should just say that, you know, we've just got this, we spoke about this in the last annual report, but in the second year in a row, the Competition Commission has won the Lawyer's Best Company to Work For in the Private Sector Award. I think that a big issue for us in this last period, and then perhaps more so in the next current and next period, is the fact that there is a Competition Amendment Act that has been signed off by the President, except for the fact that we don't have a date on which it becomes effective. This has implications for a number of things that we're going to work on, in particular the question of concurrent jurisdiction that's been clarified, I think, in the Act, in the amendment bill. It also made provision for the incorporation of the corporate leniency policy. This was, corporate leniency policy was not something that was specifically catered for in the Act. It was something that we did out of our own kind of prosecutorial discretion. It also provides for us, for the authorities to deal with complex monopoly conduct. We can talk a bit more about it, some members will be familiar with this. So it gives us, powers to conduct market inquiries, similar to what we did for banks, except that when we did the banking market inquiry, we didn't have powers to do so. We didn't have power to demand information from the parties involved in the inquiry. We made it completely voluntary. Now we don't have to make it completely voluntary. We have the ability to summon information for the market inquiry, for example. And then, of course, the most dramatic thing about the Competition Amendment Act is that it introduces personal criminal liability. The way this works, I think, this is one of the more controversial parts of this Act. Businesses, if you've seen the newspaper, have already declared and indicated that they're going to challenge this constitutionally. How this will work is, in general terms, is that after the finding of the competition authorities that an anti-competitive conduct has occurred, the National Prosecuting Authority may then proceed to prosecute the individuals that were involved in such conduct using the findings of the competition authorities as the basis upon which they will initiate investigations and prosecute individuals. So this will not be something that will be done. The prosecution of the criminal prosecution of individuals is not something that will be done by the competition authorities themselves, but the findings of the competition authorities that they have in fact been anti-competitive conduct will be used by the NPA to pursue investigation against individuals. And then finally, I'm at the end of my presentation. Finally, to say that we in the last, in this outside period of the year and review, we really looked at the strategic, we went through a second strategic planning exercise, and this was 3 years after our first one, and we kind of looked at what now for the next period will be the major priorities issued for us as a commission. And this slide just shows what we came up with as three of our major objectives for the next period. And the first is for us to begin to achieve demonstrable competitive outcomes in the economy. impact for what we're doing. I mean, so we'll kind of refine, re-look at how we prioritize to ensure that we do that wisely, we do that properly, and that we want to begin to see the results of our work. So this means, you know, things that we might not have been doing so much in the previous period, these kind of monitoring markets after we've kind of dealt with them, seeing what and kind of developing methodologies to evaluate the impact of our work. It's not a very easy thing to do, but we kind of develop a way in which we can track what the outcomes ultimately of our work is. Secondly, we see in the next period a major focus on dealing with not cases so much, but kind of policy issues that relate to the competitiveness in markets. And this has to do with dealing with kind of other stakeholders, in particular, I think other government departments who are responsible for developing policies for specific markets that fall under their area of jurisdiction, and to kind of ensure that a lot of the policies and practices. This is your kind of moral persuasion kind of strategy, where you're trying to persuade other people to do the right thing rather than using the stick of enforcement in the first instance. And we see that in the next period a lot of our work moving into that area. And then finally, we think that it's very important for an agency like ours to kind of continue to ensure that it's managed properly. That an institution like ours takes good decisions, for example, and we put a lot of kind of energy into ensuring that the organization itself is run properly, that the governance occurs properly, and good decisions are taken. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Commissioner Ram Guru. Is that correct, Ram Guru?
Absolutely.
Yes, thank you very much. So thank you very passionate for your work. What we would like to do, I know that the council would also like to make an important point. What may be useful for us, just as this is one of our first talks on CS, and time has been here so far, is for members to just seek any clarification, raise a few questions specifically on the Constitution Commission itself. We've given the annual report a few weeks back, as you know, thank you very much for doing that. And so over to the membership now. And just to remember, we're not dealing with the tribunal specifically right now. We will get that itself. It's time to fix the related policy we laid out yesterday, huh? 2 minutes maximum, and you can fit 3 questions into that well and good. Honourable Member Dixon, first one, I think I'm just getting it done. Honourable Blair, Honourable Mitsumi, Honourable Ambassador, Honourable Kosti, Honourable Ijekala.
Thank you, Chairperson. Just I would like to know, after the successes in offices and hotels, have you seen any significant decreases in prices of products produced by those companies? Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. Just a few quick ones. I think last time you have mentioned that you operate independently from the government, interference and business and all that kind of thing. But in terms of independence, to whom do you account to? Because that certainly will give an indication whether you give account to anybody. itself and go into depth. In the specific issue you have mentioned where there was a settlement between Mithal and Harmony, and then where you have now subsequently received more complaints, and that you seem like you are now going deeper into that. It seems like when there's a settlement, it's the easy way out. And I'm just concerned whether, in terms of your mandate and your objective, is whether, you know, sometimes a settlement can be really be the cheap way out for a transgressor. And how do you deal with that? Then, in terms of the financial services, you mentioned about the 28 recommendations with your money. I don't think we have received and have seen those 28 recommendations. I would very much like to see what that is, because you mentioned in your report how you have looked at banking charges. You have not mentioned, and I don't know whether that is part of that, you know, with this change in the repo rate, there's a precise change in the prime rate by all banks at one specific stage. And you know, isn't that coincidence? And what we've also seen in the financial sector, everybody is now trying to comply with the national tax requirements. But you've seen a substantial rise in banking charges. Now, is that fair competition and is that fair towards the consumer? Thank you very much. Yeah, thanks, Chairman. I'd like to know about the community outreach. How do you fare in that area? Do the community know that you know, well, what are you doing to advertise your bank? Then secondly, I wanted to check about the professional work where, particularly the construction, where we are not talking about the material. We are talking about the professional work where the builder, they will collude, build up the electrician to say the streets, the labor, to say if I'm doing this, it's going to be, do you encounter such things? And lastly, Chair, is the gap between the salaries. What are you doing to bridge for those senior employees and junior members?
Thank you.
Thank you, Comrade Chairperson. My first question is it relates to what Honorable Ndudi asked. To what degree is the public being empowered such that as we go on this journey, which will be a long journey, because the more empowered the public is, the less strain one's work will be put on the secretary. So that's a challenge. But then the other question is the action that is taken against the culprits, or the punishment that is executed, is it weighty enough to prevent such behavior from being done in the future? And then the last one is the input, the expenditure in chasing the cases. I accept that it cannot necessarily be measured in terms of rent only, but it must also be measured in terms of the intention and the overall benefit. But we get the feeling that we are making more gains
money to see for this uncompetitive behavior, and what are they used for, those money. The other one is, I'm understanding that there are few consumer organizations out there. What is the relationship between yourself and those? Because it is only when you see those in the media, you know, actually realizing that there is something wrong in terms of pricing these differentials. Do you have a relationship with those? The last one is, perhaps an individual realize that there is something wrong with these prices, how do they go about getting to report such cases, you know, to you that it can be taken up? Because the realization is that dealing with quite multi-million companies here, and an ordinary person in the street, they may think that they just know the price. How does one get to lay a charge to you so that such a case can be taken? Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Kofi. I'm going to go next.
Thanks, Jeff. That's what the comment said. I think it's worth noting that you know, someone who was present in the last term is commendable, you know, mentioning activity between the commission, that of the education and awareness sector, you know, stakeholder relations. If I remember well, you know, initially you just told about the intention, but now one concern, you know, the penetrations and failing on the assessment, even the report specifically, you know, interaction with the consumer forum, and even NGOs, you know, it's very striking, and we have repeatedly raised that in the past, and I think it's worth also again mentioning that, you know, this is what enhances working relations, because since the commission, as one of the co-agents, you know, has been responsive to the issues that we've been raising. I mean, not because they didn't have that in mind, but there you are, and I trust and hope that members who would do our bit to ensure that we support, you know, not just in meetings, but also pressure on the ground where there's an opportunity to ensure that the commission's work vis-a-vis stakeholder interaction is enhanced. Check, mine is about the report on the junk transactions. I know at some stage it was sort of embargoed, and the question is when are we going to share it? You know, some of us are itching to have a look, even if it's just a recommendation. And the private sector is very striking that, you know, the commission has begun to articulate its drive in that form. But then the question is, what is the criteria for identification of the private sector? With regard to the amendments that were introduced to this year, just from the current jurisdiction, I know when there were public hearings, there was a lot of hoopla. Even within the government itself. Now, there is a probe into the cell phone charges. I was curious to what extent would that probe concurrent with this scheme, during this jurisdiction, would be either helpful or just a time the work of the commission, or maybe even cast on the other side, because I assume that that's the other institutions that they have in the act on that matter. The human resources in the past, this has been a thorn in the flesh, and I didn't pick up, I'm still facing the same problems that, or challenges that you shared, that, you know, highest level of skilled labor. And also, the learning teaching provided on representatives of staff complement, and the particular reference on persons with disabilities. We just shared that with us. Lastly, according to the accounting authority's report, the committee has submitted an application to the National Treasury to obtain their surplus of 21.2 million for 2009-10 financial year. That classifies as 50. Thank you.
Just before the commissioner responds and the team, you did speak to mergers and acquisitions. You referred to sectors, 414 of those sectors. It would be useful to know from that if you'd be able to give us the details of how many of the other sectors within the sectors themselves, how many were small, what you classified as small, and how many were classified as large in those numbers. The second thing was the deadlines for those mergers, which you referred to on page 105 of the annual report. Could you tell us the statutory deadline for the merger cases to be finalized off to indicate that time? The other issue is with respect to the HR in a way, in which you refer to the manager of mergers and acquisitions, again in the internet, in the annual report on page 28, Martin Van Hoorn, I think it is. How long was the first vacant for? And what are the implications for vacancies in this division when figures, I have no idea how long that was the case. Relating again to the mergers and acquisitions itself, you know, you made some reference, and perhaps I can share you at the time, as to the number that were received between 2008 and 2009 financial year that have not been completed. Or have they all been completed? I imagine they haven't as yet. If we could just get that. There are other references with respect to the annual report and the Auditor General, which refers to the statement. And I actually did ask our content specialist exactly where these statements had occurred. And he was of the opinion, as was earlier, that this may have been a typo. But perhaps you'll clarify it to yourself. The Auditor General refers to this statement. And that is a typo, and where is that typo as such? And regarding the deficit which you referred to in that report, you have a deficit, you have a surplus, and an investment. Just clarify that kind of situation. What is the surplus intended for, and why the deficit? I know that it stands to be on a deficit narrative, but it can give us the motivation.
First question is about whether we've seen successes in cartels. I mean, I think that's a very important question, and it kind of relates to something I tried to speak about at the end in terms of the next strategic set of priorities that we have. You know, I think that anecdotally we hear of, you know, following the announcement of a cartel that prices change, prices go down. So yesterday, Simon Roberts, our chief economist, was saying about how since in the living sector, for example, in the Northwest province and the Mpumalanga provinces, following the announcement, even just the announcement that there is a living cartel, kind of prices dropped, and they weren't stable. But this is very anecdotal evidence that I would not kind of, you know, make much off because we can't kind of back it up. I think a few things need to be said about this. One is that, you know, one of the things we do in initiating a case, one of the things that happens is we disrupt a cartel. We stop it from operating. You know, everybody who were once cozy pals with each other now begin to distrust each other. And that is one of the most valuable things we do. We kind of just break up this cozy relationship that people have had. And that, and what ought to, what does happen and ought to happen is over time markets then kind of adjust to a new equilibrium place because they've been disrupted. They're not functioning like they previously did. And I think the bottom line is that it does take time for you to see the results of it. It's not like you do it today and tomorrow the price will fall. The one very, very significant case that we've had is about antiretrovirals, where this wasn't a case that was kind of, this was also a case that got settled in the end, where it was against Glaxo Wellcome and two other pharmaceutical companies, where at the time that we started the case, the cost of antiretrovirals was something like 4,000 rand a month for a patient. And by the 4,000 in that vicinity. And essentially what this case did in the end is that whereas you know, the start off with these Glaxo Wellcome and others had patent rights over these antiretrovirals, the agreement we reached with them is that they would out-license these products and allow generic manufacturers to produce them as well. And when that happened subsequently, the price came down to something like 400 rand a month, so from 4,400. That was a case that, so you see generic manufacturers coming in, and it's not just the gen, so you've got a cost of the price of a patented product. You've got generic manufacturers coming, paying, you know, charging much less, which means even the cost of the patented product decreases. So all the cost prices decrease as a consequence of that. I mean, we are fortunate to have an example like that. And this is a case that was finished, what, 4 or 5 years ago. And it kind of takes some time for you to kind of collate all this information to say this is what happened. So, I mean, that's a clear case where we have some data on others is just anecdotal and it is something that takes time. I mean, I think that's the point I'm making. The question of independence and who we come to. Well, I mean, here, you know, like all public agencies, we come ultimately to you, okay, via the Minister of Trade. So that's in the kind of accounting we do now. If you look at our annual report saying what the activities are and how we spend our money, it kind of, you know, we go to the Department of Trade and Industry, to Parliament, like I'm sure other agents. I personally have a performance meeting with the Minister once a year, and that's how the supervision occurs there. But I think equally and perhaps more important in this system is something we touched on a little bit yesterday, is the way in which the institutions are organized and the way in which they carry out their proceedings. So, more importantly here, the Competition Commission is in terms of the substantive issues, the matters, the cases, is has to convince a tribunal in a public hearing that it must adopt one or other position, and then the tribunal decides whether we're right or wrong, and has to make its decision available to the general public, put it on the website, justifying why it thinks we're right or wrong. And if somebody is unhappy with the tribunal decision, they can then take to the Competition Appeal Court where the same thing applies. And I think that is perhaps the most effective thing that holds us accountable. We are accountable through that process. We're accountable first from one institution to the next, and the fact that we have to do this publicly makes us, and that we're subject to this kind of rigorous judicial standard that we've got to set in justifying our decisions. So I hope that kind of answers that question. How investigations are initiated, the short answer is both ways. We have to, people complain, and that's an answer to another question. Anybody can kind of complain to the competition authority. There's a set of procedures through which you do that. There's a form you fill in, it's on our website. You know, the commission staff can help people to make that complaint properly. We send that complaint to the screening unit that looks at whether this is a competent complaint in terms of the act and our jurisdiction. We get lots of other sorts of complaints that's got nothing to do with us, you know, that's kind of contractual. Two business people had a fight, a contractual issue, and they try to bring it to us. Those are not competition issues. So we have screen cases and make sure we kind of pursue the purely competition cases. And so we deal with complaints, but the commissioner can also initiate a complaint of his or her own accord, which is something, as one of our clients has shown, we've been increasingly doing in the recent past. So some individual might complain about a matter that isn't kind of directly maybe a competition issue, there's a problem, we know there's a problem, but we can't pin it down in terms of the kind of legal standards we require to make a case on competition issues, and we might not pursue it. But then, after getting four or five complaints of similar nature, the commissioner is then obliged to say, okay, look, there's something going on here that kind of constructs a case that covers all of these other complainants in some way or the other, and construct it so that it kind of meets those legal standards. So the short answer there is both things happen, and increasingly in the past we have been initiating our own complaints, particularly arising out of us having prioritized sectors, and we kind of know that those are the sectors in which we will deal with these matters. There's a kind of question around whether a settlement is an easy way out and a cheap way out for responding to the matter. Just remember a point I made earlier on is sometimes the kind of opposite is true. Sometimes it's true that a respondent just pursuing legal strategies and paying lawyers is a cheaper strategy than having to stop a behavior that's earning that firm enormous amounts of profit. So, having said that, I think that what we would do as an agency is that when we, the kind of overriding principle in deciding on settlement is comparing the settlement with what we would have won should we pursued the case to completion and got a judgment out of it. You know, we'll compare what we wanted out of that judgment with what we get in the settlement. And if they're too far apart, we won't settle. But if they're fairly kind of close to each other, that will say, look, on balance, if we're asking for a fine for 50 million rand and the settlement was 48, we'll take the settlement. We're not going to kind of quibble over, So there must be a similarity. We must get in the settlement what we would have won should we win the case through the court system. And that's kind of overriding kind of principle there. Regarding the banking inquiry and the recommendations and that. There are two questions around that. I think that firstly, this kind of issue with this report is on our website. Okay, it's a public report. It's available. We original print version to bring to Parliament to hand out here, we'd be happy to do so. Just to kind of give you some context here, though, what happened here is that our report got finalized in June 2008. When the report got finalized, the industry, the banks, which were given us information on a voluntary basis, were kind of concerned that we were including in the report some information that they had declared confidential. So we took some time going through that report with the lawyers of the banks, identifying which information they felt was confidential and we ought not to be revealing the public in a general. And we told them our view was that, well, you know, we're blacking it out in the report and you will take responsibility for blacking it out. So wherever it's blacking out, it will say blacking out by Standard Bank. Okay? And we took this approach because we were a bit afraid this whole thing was going to be used to prevent this report from being made public. So we said, you know, okay, we'll blacken it out, but we'll definitely make it public. That was a better route to take, and then they would be accountable for whatever they blacken out. So that took some time. Then in September last year, as everybody is aware, what happened in the world over was an international financial crisis. Okay, it hit the world big time. And the Commission was persuaded by the Minister of Finance that we needed to be very careful about the way in which we go about releasing a report that might be critical of our banks in a climate like that, that would have resulted in kind of just exacerbating a already difficult situation. We argued with him that none of this stuff, none of what he's saying, you know, has those kinds of dimensions to it. But he pointed out, I think, quite correctly, that a lot of these things are based on sentiment, and a complicated report like that could easily be misunderstood, misconstrued, if taken to the wrong place. So that happened in September, so we had to manage the release of this report very carefully. Eventually, we released the report in December. Okay? And that was just when the crisis was by no means over, but it seemed like it wasn't as dramatic as September when we were going to release it. And so that's where we at, in that score. What happened also last year then is when we released the report, this committee, a few people in the current committee, this committee did call us to make a presentation to the Parliamentary Portfolio Committee of Trade and Industry. But this was in the early parts of this year. But then, you know, a whole lot of things happened that kind of distracted Parliament's focus at that time, including the elections that came soon afterwards, and we never actually did it. But we were invited, we were on the agenda, we prepared our slides, and at the last minute we were told not to, you know, the other things took over. So that's something we could be still prepared to do. Community outreach. As I pointed out, this is increasingly work that we want to do. Our stakeholders are sometimes, our stakeholders are sometimes pretty sophisticated bunch of people. You know, we're talking about businesses and lawyers and regulators, and so when one uses the word community, I don't have don't imagine that we kind of going out in rural areas informing people about competition law in an abstract sort of way. We are kind of targeting our work to those people who are directly involved in a meaningful way, closely to markets, in markets. Kind of solving the problems that competition and competitive behavior results. However, we have, as Comrade Nicolani has pointed out, we have been doing a lot of work with consumer organizations, which is a problem in this country because there are not many consumer organizations, and insofar as they exist, they don't have, they're not as strong as, say, kind of other formations in civil society. But we've kind of extended beyond that. So we have good relationships with the National Consumer Forum, with the Black Sash, with COSATU and the trade unions. We have a very good, all the trade union formations. We have regular contacts with them. We run workshops with them. We invite us to their meetings to kind of inform them on big issues, policy issues, even. So it is, as I kind of indicated yesterday as well, this is a very, very important part of our work, because one cannot expect, I think, the competition authorities by themselves to solve all these anti-competitive problems in that exist in our economy. Other stakeholders that have direct interests in them need to also be doing their bit in order to address these issues. So having very kind of discerning, discriminate consumers, for example, who refuse to buy product A for some reason related to anti-competitive behavior or pricing and chooses to buy product B, is the kind of thing we need. That might not be, you know, that might be something that's more relevant to a more perhaps middle class consumer base, or something more relevant to richer countries. But I think it's something that we need to see more of here as well. A lot of the consumer issues, direct consumer issues, ought to be the sharper kind of policy instrument for that is this new consumer bill that the DGI is, the Consumer Act, the consumer protection laws that the DGI is finalizing right now. And that would be very important to play a very important complementary role to us, because that law and that set of institutions will do the kinds of things that we can't do. We there primarily to fix the way markets work, and in those markets working better, they benefit consumers, rather than taking up the cudgels of an individual consumer. I think that's a very important point. We don't take up cudgels for individual consumers or firms. We're not lawyers for individual consumers and firms. We are a public policy agency that wants the market to work better, and in doing so, will have benefits for everybody. That's not a very well understood thing, I think, and I think it's important to understand that we're not there to fight individual battles. We fix the market as a whole, and it's to make everybody better off. I wasn't certain about the professional work and the builders and the electricians. I wasn't certain about what that question was about.
No,
are you covered then? Okay. And then salaries between junior and senior, you talk about within the organization or in our organization, the commission. Okay. Well, you know, people might well be aware that we've had a very long battle with we were starting off working off on a scale that was not the public sector scale. And then public sector salaries went up last year sometime quite substantively, and we found that we ended up earning less than even the public sector in a context where we were competing with the private sector for our human resources. So, and essentially in the last 2 months, it was 2 months ago that this problem got resolved, basically. I mean, we are now on the public sector scale. People are earning the salaries equivalent to public sector, which I must say are after the adjustments, are fairly competitive. We've kind of hopefully resolved that matter. We're still certainly not paying as much as some private sector law firms, for example, are paying, but I think we kind of also attract a different personality to our institutions that might not be, you know, that's not such a big deal, hopefully. So that was also just to say one of the issues that got caught up between the change of administration. So the previous minister, a week before with the election, sent a letter to the Minister of Finance, who only picked it up 2 months later because it got changed in between, and that was an issue that we had a snare around, but hopefully it's behind us. The question of public empowerment, hopefully I've answered that. Okay, are the actions of the culprits weighty enough to prevent them from doing this behavior? And that is the big question for us. I mean, the big question when you set a fine is it disincentive enough? You know, is this enough of a disincentive to prevent somebody from doing things? Now, the thing I need to point out here is, firstly, the way in which this law was conceived of to start off with, as we're all aware, is not criminal law. It's not something that criminalizes people until the Amendment Act, by Amendment Bill. Right? So up to that point, what we were worked in the realm of civil law, administrative penalties, essentially, you know, the best way to explain this is that these fines that we've been levying on people, these fines are not meant to be punishment. These fines are meant to be disincentive. They're like traffic fines. You know, people hand out traffic fines not to punish somebody, but to prevent them from behaving badly on the road. And you'll find that.
Secondly, it's kind of very minor. I know it's not. Some of your work is kind of overlapping with the work between yourself and yourself. Now, we will be hearing from the tribunal. But I'm my understanding and the reason that the actual meaning of fines, a lot of that, the hearing would be more on the tribunal, in the tribunal area. Is that correct?
When we levy a fine, because a fine comes about either through us reaching an agreement with the party and saying, you know, the consent agreement we have and consent to a fine, or a fine results after we go through the entire case, make our case, and tribunal makes a call. But even in instances where we consent, we have to take that to the tribunal for the tribunal to endorse it. And in theory, the tribunal has the right to say, look, your fine is too low, your fine is too high. They can reopen it in theory. They haven't done so, but they usually defer to our judgment as the commission, but in theory, they have the ability to do that as well.
It's just that we didn't want the overlap.
No. I think I'm making another point here about kind of, you know, the difference between a kind of administrative fine and a criminal punishment, if you like. And the kind of analogy, although sometimes it's not wise to compare us with traffic cops, but the traffic cop analogy is not a bad one, because when you're driving the road, you will see a sign that says 120 kilometers an hour with a camera above it. What it means is that those guys don't want to catch you. What they want you to do is they want you to drive below 120. Because in complying with the law, we are all better off. So these fines that we charge are not there to punish people. They're to prevent them from doing something that will make us all worse off. And we would rather they didn't do it. Because it's not like we want to catch them. Okay? I think that's very, very important. That's how the whole system was conceptualized. What happened in the recent past is that there's been, because of the complete kind of intransigence of business when we kind of caught out people and the way they responded to it, people got extremely outraged and said, look, this is completely not on. These guys are, despite being these bad things, are still getting away with it. Let's put them all in jail. There was like a big public swell and big public response to that, and you know, to what was not the kind of response that was we were expecting. And that's where we kind of moving now to kind of criminalization, which is something that we've spoken about and something the NPA will take over. So whether the fines are high enough to prevent this, if that is the trick. The trick is to work out at what level that must be. And, I mean, you know, you're going to get as many views on that as there are people. Then the question is about, the next question was about expenditure and taking cases must be measured on overall benefits. I mean, I think that's a point well taken, well made, and it's something that we might see in deciding. You know, we have, as an agency, a certain prosecutorial discretion. In other words, it would not be wise for us to pursue something that costs too much with a very small chance of success. Then we've got to apply our mind and say, let's not go down that road. Let's drop that case, for example, because it's going to cost us enormous amounts of money and the chance of success is very small. So we do factor all of these things, and not only the fine, but the kind of effectiveness of our remedy on a matter, and how that will kind of affect the market generally is something we will take into account as well. A breakdown of money we've got for anti-competitive behavior and what they're used for. Our annual report has a list of everybody we find in the past annual, in the period under review. That money, we do not see at all. It goes straight to the fiscal side, DGI. We don't see that money. We're not meant to. There's good reasons for that. There's the kind of... So we get... You know, the money goes straight to the fiscal and we get our grants from DGI. The money we keep as an institution is the money that is there as a filing fee for mergers. Okay? And we can predict how much of that money comes in. Last year, we predicted that mergers would fall and to a greater extent than they did, and we got more money from that source than we thought we would, and that answers another question about the surplus. Mm-hmm. Okay, and I think that is explained in the report somewhere. Consumer organizations have answered that individuals wanting to make a complaint. I think I've answered that. Any individual can make a complaint. And then priority sector is what criteria for identification. And here, I think we've kind of set that down in previous reports and presentations to the committee. Primarily, we set a set of criteria out for how we would select these cases. And amongst those criteria is we said we would concentrate on markets that affects the majority of South Africans, in particular poor people. So we're looking at markets that affect that section of the population. So we're not looking at, you know, excessive prices for buying Lamborghinis, for example. That's not something we're looking at yet. That's the first criteria. We're then looking at aligning our enforcement activities with government strategy, government policy, and government strategy. So, for example, you know, the fact that we're looking at intermediate industrial products like chemicals and steel is something that's in line with thinking in government that that you know, South Africa needs to develop its manufacturing sector, and these inputs into the manufacturing sector are very, very high, and that is why our manufacturing sector is not developing. And if you bring down the cost of inputs into manufacturing, we will kind of grow the economy by developing a stronger manufacturing sector. And those are basically, you know, that comes to our steel cases, for example, and our chemical cases. And then we look at other criteria like the cost of doing business. So the cost of doing business is, you know, particularly if you're a small business, you are counting your income, you're counting your cents at the end of the month, bank charges kind of really hit you hard. You know, so that accounts for like those cross-cutting costs to all businesses. So for example, bank charges would be how we, using that criteria, how we arrive there. Telecommunications would be another. These are things that contribute towards the cost of doing business in this country. Those are the markets we need to be dealing with. So those are the criteria issue. I'm not sure if I've dealt with all the HR issues. The representativity of our staff, we didn't think we needed to do that because we kind of, we just need to look at the photograph. We didn't kind of break down, we did break down in kind of race and gender accessibility, but certainly we are representative, I think. You know, we're fortunate to be a kind of new South Africa institution. We set up post-1999. We don't have all these kind of transformation problems that some other agencies have, so we were able to build our institution up, kind of complying with these things from the very start. But I'm sorry that information is not there for you. I'm going to ask Nelly to answer the question on retaining surpluses. And the question of turnover of our skilled staff, you know, I think that this is something that comes up all the time and everybody kind of expects this of us, in other words, to have a high turnover. I think there's some important things to know here. We have a very, very young staff. You need to look at those photographs. These were our upwardly mobile people who are on the go. And with the kind of age profile of our staff, one cannot but expect a kind of relatively steady kind of turnover of people moving on. But I'm very, very pleased to say we have stemmed that. You know, that's not like an epidemic. That's not the thing that's kind of crippling us now. Not the biggest problem. Indeed, what we have is quite the opposite. We are having, a significant number, not hordes of them, but a significant number of staff returning to the commission. So, like three of the managers three of the senior managers of the six that we have right now, are people returned back to the commission. They've gone to other places and they've come back. So, you know, I don't think that we're always going to have problems of high staff turnover with the kind of staff profile we have, but I don't see that as the biggest issue.
We have the managing the time here as well. We can just complete what you're saying, and there were three or four other questions.
Okay,
we'll get to them in the next few minutes.
In 1 minute, the M&A stats on small, intermediate, and large. I can't remember that offhand. I'll be surprised if it's not in the booklet, but if it's not, we can give it to you. That's fine. The manager for our mergers, I don't think that was kind of, I'm not sure the exact time, but it wasn't an enormous period of time. I think we did that fairly rapidly. And we had Tendi Kwesi Donakele, subsequently was appointed as a deputy commissioner, acted in that post for a long time, for that period of time. I might have not answered some of your questions on mergers, but I'd like Nelly to very quickly answer the financial questions, because I don't think those are important.
Thank you very much, Commissioner. We can just have those two responses, and then we're going to take a tea break, a short tea break, and then come back. Let's just get the balance of those questions on the screen.
Just in terms of
we normally, in terms of the PFMA, have to submit our financial statements in May. And you have an opportunity after the 31st of May to make adjusting entries. And the way the Auditor General is now reporting is to look at what those adjusting entries are. And one of the main ones that we did go through after this was that we had moved the corporate services division to another block. And we hadn't received the rent for 4 months, and we had to do a provision for 4 months for the rent. And that's why they record it, because they have to record it what were the changes. And that change was in net effect about 400,000 rand between the two periods and the final account. In terms of the accumulated surplus in the deficit, we've been in the past being able to carry forward our accumulated surpluses to be used for expenditure. The income you see wasn't sufficient enough for our expenditure, so we had a deficit, and we had the accumulated surplus to rely on. The 21.4 million that we had made in application to the Trinity, which we have to do every year, we're still waiting for approval, and we don't expect to need that any longer. So that's where the change is. Sorry? I mean, those misstatements are the differences, the timing, and that has to be recorded by the Auditor General between what you submitted at the end of May and what your final account is. Yes.
Those decisions of the commission in
We do a number of things. We obviously adjudicate the referral. There is a procedure known as interim relief because these cases take a long time, and a complainant has a right to bring in this interim relief application, which is to get relief that lasts for 6 months or until the final case is decided, so we can do that as well. And we also hear appeals from the Commission's decisions of people who get exempted under the Act. Typically, that hasn't happened at all yet. Those are the kind of cases that we've heard in this particular year. You can see that the majority of cases that have been heard have actually been associated with large mergers. Slightly misleading figure in the sense that although that most of the cases are mergers, they account for the least amount of work time because most mergers go quite quickly or are unopposed. And most of the work is in fact spent on the complicated case, either a merger or a complaint referral. So those are just stats on what we have been doing. I just want to highlight only one point on the slide. You can see it's quite a high figure for what I call the procedural matters. And you might say, why, where's the value of the system if you're engaged in procedural matters? And I just want to highlight that for your issue and explain to you how important procedural issues are to the system when I come to another slide involving another firm that's relevant to that history. Large merger trends, this is a slide which shows you that the increase in the amount of mergers that we heard up until this period. In this particular year, there were no prohibitions of any mergers, but there were a small number of that were approved without condition. What that slide really tells you is increase in mergers being notified, and the fact that the majority of mergers, close to 90%, in fact, do get approved. But that's fairly typical for a system where people have to notify mergers in advance. Now, people do not notify mergers because they think they might be anti-competitive, otherwise nobody would come along and tell you that. They notify mergers because if you're above a certain threshold and you meet the legal definition of what is called a merger, you must notify. The other slide you've seen earlier was about the fact that tribunal hearing days are taking longer. That's symptomatic of the fact that cases are becoming more complex and we are spending more time on that. So the slide's not telling you how many cases we've heard, but how many are taking more than a day, which is a way of trying to estimate what is the degree of complexity that's being introduced into the system. This slide here is about important new decisions that were made in that particular year. And we just go through what they were. In a case that Shannon already mentioned involving storage of grain silos when we responded to the tender, we found that it interpreted what is called a margin squeeze. The importance of this particular case is recognizing a margin squeeze is an important development in the jurisprudence because typically a margin squeeze occurs when the dominant firm sells to a customer and also competes with that customer downstream. And typically in firms that were either recently privatized or were deregulated in some way, as in the case of grain storage, margin squeeze is fairly typical because the dominance has remained resilient upstream, but they were competitors in the downstream market where there's more money, and they tend to raise the cost of their rivals and reduce their own, in order to reduce the degree of competition. So recognizing the margin squeeze as a jurisprudential question is important not just for this particular case, but other cases that the Commission might bring, for instance, is an obvious example of the telecommunication industry. The others have been various procedural cases. Shan has already mentioned these procedural cases, and I'm not going to go into them any further. This just gives you a statistics of the number of cases that we've heard. I don't want to say too much about this slide. Just the last point I think is quite important because we members have asked about the when. And I just wanted to point out about 335 meter reports that we've sourced and monitored by the tribunal about what's going on. So it gives you a sense of how much the media is doing to make what we do important out there. Here is the slide which probably everybody is interested in the presentation. We've levied 303 million rand of fines over that year, and this is the, as it were, the hall of shame of various firms that were that paid the fines. In this particular year, all these fines have come about as a result of consent orders entered
to us to decide whether the fine is either overreaching the firm concerned or overreaching the public. In other words, we supervise the fine and see its progress, and if we don't fix the progress, we will make it, we will say so. And we've done so in one particular case. We were then taken to appeal by the Commission. The appeal court went this way, not our way, but I'd simply use it as an example to say we don't simply rubber stamp the Commission. If we don't agree with what the fine is, we will say so. Technically, what would happen if we don't agree with it, the Commission and the party can either come back and say, look, maybe the tribunal will be happy with it, or the case then becomes a closed case itself in the ordinary way. But we can't, in a consent order case, impose our own view because it only comes to us in a consent order case. If there's no consent, we haven't got jurisdiction to give an order. But if I can just stop on that one, if you see that firm, American National Soda Ash, Natural Soda Ash, 9 million rand, and I mentioned to you the importance of procedural issues. This is a case that was eventually settled by a consent order that took the system 7 years to process. It was probably one of our earliest cases and was the longest to settle. Why did it take 7 years? Because over the course of 7 years, there were an innumerable number of procedural points taken by the respondent firm, which was a firm of American multinational soda ash producers in what is called a Red Pomeranian Association. The Commission called what they call the Red Pomeranian Association a cartel, and hence we had this case. And they challenged all sorts of procedural and technical points, ranging from whether the complaint was properly described to whether the Competition Appeal Court was the final court of appeal in the competition system. Eventually, 7 years later, this case started to run on the merits. In other words, the procedural points had been all gone out of the way. The case was now run on the merits. Ran for 2 weeks from the merits. At the time that the CEO was called to get evidence, he had come out from the United States to get evidence. The day he was due to get his evidence, we were told he was not coming, so they were closing their case. Great surprise, as everybody said, the CEO explained back in the Nations Association. Within a few weeks, they had settled with the Commission and hence to have the consent order. The point is that the procedural points are often the last of the line of resistance in terms fighting the Commission, hoping that if they win the procedural points, they can win the day. And hence, it's a very important part of our work that we clarify the procedural jurisprudence. It's not superfluous or a waste of time. It's a very, very important part of the system. And often we find that the procedural points are resolved eventually against the dominant firm or a firm accused of cartel activity. Eventually, when the procedural points have dried up, their lawyers have run out of ideas, firms eventually settle with the Commission. The other point that I just wanted to raise in talking about the slide was questions were asked as to whether fines are working or not. In other words, are firms learning a lesson from getting the fines? From the point of view of the tribunal, we can only comment on cases that have become before us. The Commission obviously has much more information coming into it than we have. But we have no evidence that there is any recidivism in the system. In other words, what I mean is there's no evidence that people who've been caught out once are being caught out again. Now, some people might say, well, how come certain firms have come up, their names have come up several times as being involved in cartels? I would point out the cases that we've had, those cartel allegations were historical and had all preceded the initial fine that we gave them on the firm. So as yet, as before the tribunal, there's no indication, no evidence that fines are not working. We could be wrong on that. I'm just talking about the evidence that has gone before us. The other questions are sort of fines were a question was asked where the fines go and say they're going to the National Revenue Fund. It's worth raising with the committee that members of the public expressed to us a dissatisfaction that the money goes to just a general fund. They feel the money isn't used sufficiently to redress the particular victims of that cartel. Now, it needs to be pointed out that it would be quite difficult to work out exactly who were the victims of that cartel and pay them 50 cents for each loaf of bread they bought. And that would involve internal administrative litigation problems to determine that. So that's why the system works for this. But whether there could be a more dedicated use of that money in from Treasury is an interesting question, one on our lead with the committee. For instance, I want to link it to the fact that there is a civil remedy in the system. Those victims of anti-competitive offences, even if there has been fine imposed, may
might have bought bread at a high price, would be able to show that they in fact bought bread from a particular bakery and are pleaded guilty. The second is the cost of litigation, and we have no class action for damages in South African law. But one of the linkages between perhaps the fines that are levied and the civil action is that perhaps the funds should be available to something like the Legal Aid Board, which could be used to fund litigation by private litigants on an appropriate basis against responding firms. The next slide is about participation in the international body. Now, here I just wanted to highlight the fact that my predecessor, David Lewis, has been appointed chairman of the International Competition Network, which is an association of all the international competition agencies, and that was obviously a great honor for South Africa that one of our own was recognized in this position of two. David Lewis is credited that he was appointed to this position. We also continue to be involved in the OECD and their competition group. Our financial management here, I just want to point out to you the percentages that we get from government grants, from our filing fees and our other income. Our total income has been around 20 million for last year. Our expenditure was around 17 million. As with the commission on this next slide, you'll see that most of our expenditure is on personnel. We are quite a lean organisation, as you'll see from later slides, so it's largely on personnel. These were in the course of this year, our tribunal panels are appointed tribunal members are appointed for 5-year terms. And in the course of this year, at the end of July, the old tribunal panels finished their term of office, which included our chair and our deputy chair, and those were our previous members. And as from 1st of August, the new panel started with myself as chairman, William Sela Malunga, and Malunga as the deputy chair. Just to remark a little bit about the new members who will now serve for 5-year term. Of those new members, 8 of people with previous experience serve already in the tribunal have had either 5 or more years' experience in the tribunal, 3 are new. So there's been a good balance between the old and the new. In terms of the other demographics, the race demographics, there are 6 black members and 5 white members. In terms of gender, there are 6 women and 5 men. And in terms of professional expertise, there are 8 lawyers and 3 economists. Sounds like a frightening combination in the field. And as far as our tribunal staff complement is, because not all of our tribunal members, only 3 are full-time members. That's myself, Anthony Karim, and Andre Vessel. The remaining members are part-time. We only pay them when they actually allocate the case. But we have a full-time staff complement of 14. They divide into 3 divisions: corporate services, research, and registry, and these are our various managers. So that takes care of our staff. Thank you.
Thank you,
Chair. Thank you.
Thank you very much for that presentation. I would like to welcome Honorable Amrofin to this meeting. We have done a presentation on the Competition Commission. Then we did ask questions and responded. Now it is the tribunal, and we are going to start from there. We are going to ask questions relevant to the tribunal. So I'll give the members to ask questions. Whatever Maria is number 1, number 2 I will go to, number 3, whatever Mabasa, number 4, only those 3 in that order. Sister Nigelana, number 4, number 5, in that order. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you very much for the submission. Some of these questions that I've been asking, I'll
in on the independence. The commission is actually, the system commission is actually concerned that, you know, that independence is a relevant thing. It is actually concerned with the minister has asked and requested not to be independent and publish the document at one stage. So that's my question, my first one to you is, with whom in government do you liaise? And I mean, in what regards can there be a perceived implication of your independency? You know, typically the example that I've mentioned, that the commission has mentioned. Then the second one, you have mentioned where you oversee the findings and the work of the commission, but you are also in a very close partnership. It looks like friends who is watching over each other. And you know, the fact that and there's only one case you've mentioned, and there it seems like the commission was just good, damn good in the work, or is it just a tendency where it seems like the tribunal doesn't disagree with the commission? Is that pure coincidence, or are they just that good? And which is obviously part of the question, you know, in terms of your relevance there. The other one in terms of cartel and the work that you do, we have basically seen a situation where basically collusion between South African importers and foreign companies exporting to South Africa in terms of under invoicing, in terms of different ways that money flow into bank accounts. And that in itself is taking away revenue from the government in terms of people's duties, and it's obviously bringing in unfair competition between producers and foreign companies exporting to South Africa. Obviously there you've got foreign organizations and South African companies. To what extent can you deal effectively with things like that? And have you had, are there any examples where you've dealt with foreign companies? That's great.
Thank you, one of my friends at the podcast.
Thank you, Chen. The presenter, when you were referring to the redress of particular people and said it might be very difficult. I think in that way you put a scenario that nothing can be done. You see, during you know, apartheid, when you know there was TRC and it took its course and it looked like nothing could be done. And later we saw there was corruption. Even though we as South Africans did not actually take the pill. I think that in such matters, we need not wait until other people take that upon themselves. We need to be proactive in terms of looking at the opportunities of that kind of interest, even though you say money goes to the treasury. But I think, as the previous presenter was saying, that you don't worry about people who buy expensive Lamborghini and they drive to there. But even the people who are, you know, doing this, they may choose the poor people and knowing full well that they very little have them to do in terms of protecting or defending themselves against the multinational. The second issue I want to raise is, you see, this year we deal with really big business, multinational, and I want to hear from you, how do you make sure that there is no corruption, because these people have got big money. And one of the things they could do is to make sure that the case is made so weak and perhaps colluding with staff members, and that's because it would be cheaper for them to give individuals money than going and face a tribunal and actually have to pay millions. It is an area that is of great concern. So
getting a word of congrats for the chair being appointed to the international competition network. Indeed, it does do us proud as South Africa. Then, my questions go into these areas. To what degree are you making impact to the public? You know, to what degree is the public feeling the impact? And at the same time, are there ways of utilizing the public so that this tool becomes a people's tool? You know, if I could put it that way, because that way it is better, because you then have a broad support base and many eyes. And then what should we, as members of parliament, is there a specific role that you think, or a certain gap that you think we can help close as members of parliament in two aspects, in our community, in our community work, as well as when we interact with the public, because our public is broad, and as stakeholders. And then productivity and investigative capacity. How well are we doing there in the sense of where proactivity prevents bad things from happening, but if they have happened, is it feared that this lion will investigate and find me? Then the last one, I don't know if I missed it in the presentation, but the percentage of cases won versus the reported cases, that ratio, how does it stand?
Thank you, this is Honorable Mabasa. The next one is Honorable Mabasa.
Yes, thank you. Firstly, I would really support the idea of ensuring that the legal aid board gets sensitized, you know, to investigations from who are within the civil society. I think it would be really important to the issue of procedural matters is one of them, because then the genetic proof that whoever has been trying to fight a case, you know, ends up being guilty. And the question that comes in my mind, what about naming and shaming campaign for those matters? You know, if others actually go for the lenience and try to work out deals, then it's become a five or 7 years, you know. One point that has been litigated on merit, it only takes 2 weeks and the whole thing becomes complicated. If I'm correct, it says it takes 2 weeks. Then it will take your time. And I think fundamentally also the morality issue there, you know, that level of intransigence. I would rather them take kindness. Just two questions today. On the measures approved with Kondishin, can you just give us a few examples on Kondishin that were administered at Kondishin? And secondly, are there any cases of such measures approved with Kondishin which whoever the company that failed to meet Kondishin?
Thank you, Mr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Again, my apologies for being late. I was I had to deal with a deal in traffic. But through you, Mr. Chairman, sir, I had the opportunity of reading the book you gave us yesterday and familiarizing myself with the work of the tribunal. And I'm aware that you are in South Africa, perhaps one of the
like to put to you three considerations or three statements of belief to elicit your reaction, because I think that your being here should also guide us, not in respect of what the system is now, but how it can be improved. The first one is that I feel that the present system would be greatly improved by adding the component of private enforcement, enabling people to bring an action, as it happens in the United States, against a company which damages them on account of anti-competitive behavior, with the benefit of receiving triple damages, irrespective of any action taken by the commission. That is because historically one sees the decentralized how the enforcement actions by the government follow policies, at times they're stringent, at times they're not stringent. This is the first thing. The second, about private enforcement with triple action. The second thing on the class actions that you mentioned, I believe that class action for damages are an absolute necessity. In your field and more general, because nobody can sue for less than 100,000 rand because that was the cost. But the possibility of recovering damages on, in respect of an entire class enables litigation to take place when an individual is not economically viable. This might be for you to comment on in your specific field and if you may more generally. The third aspect actually is the question. you made reference to, I'm sorry, I'm not sure whether it refers to as judges or adjudicators in your tribunal, lots of detail. But however, they are referred to being accosted on a part-time basis, if I understood it correctly. Who are they? What qualification? How does one apply? And who also applies that?
The last one from this side. If you can take control, does the tribunal have? If you can elaborate on whether how is the tribunal helping the poor community that has been trying to raise that question, because we want to find out whether the poor community does get assistance from your tribunal. Thank you.
She's sort of just expecting your last step. How to help the poor in general, or to bring a particular case before the tribunal?
No, I mean, in general, how is the poor being assisted by the tribunal from the commission up to you?
In terms of that, to the extent that there might be some overlap in the question, I'll try and answer them at once. Let me deal firstly with the independence question. I have worked for the tribunal in 10 years, and I have met Mr. Australian Industry on one occasion. That was on Tuesday when we went to a COTI meeting of the Mr. Australian Industry. He said, hello, congratulations on your appointment. That was the end of our conversation. So there is very little contact with the ministry. Literally, my predecessor would have had some slightly more contact. But those have actually been over issues such as with meetings, such as budgets. Where tribunal members, where we basically, we needed to appoint new tribunal members, that is done by the presidents on the recommendation, and this has been raised at the order when that's had it come to be. In terms of the content of the individual decision, I certainly had no conversation with any minister during this period, nor to my knowledge has any of the my predecessor. And it is actually, I'm tentatively surprised by the fact that there have been for our independence of our decision making. We're independent to the extent that we've got legislation, we have to interpret that, and some people we've interpreted that incorrectly, then we are taking on appeal, that's where we are comfortable. vice versa, we think that they haven't, they should have stopped something where they have. And the same happens in enforcement cases where we've taken a different view from the commission, where they might not be successful, or we, in the case of the child, for instance, the commission did not bring that case itself, there wasn't a case, yet we've made a finding that there had been a contravention, the act of appeal court has said, you know, we know the history that you apply the wrong case, go back and do it and do that in a way. So it's an example where there's been differences between us and the commission. In so far as I think it links to the question that Mr. Cotty asked about the corruption in the system. And it's quite right to say there's a huge amount of money at stake there. And one has got to be alert to the possibility of corruption. I mean, had the Mattel decision that we had made been upheld, the firm would have been liable for fines of 690 million rand. So these are huge fines. Is there a fear of corruption? Well, I think because institutionally the system is designed to prevent that. Firstly, there's a separation between adjudication, which is what we do, and prosecution, which is what the commission does. Secondly, even if there was a failing at the commission stage, in other words, somebody who should have been prosecuted didn't get called to court, but the Act as it currently stated gives people a private complaint the right to bring a complaint even if the commission does. And in the case of this, and I'm not suggesting for a moment there's any wrong with the commission decision, but the legal decision to make at the time. But the private complainant there thought it had a case. The commission said we don't care of the case. But the private complainant was able to bring the case to the system and bring it to the tribunal. Well, then you can say, what happens about corruption at the level of the tribunal? Well, two factors. One is the tribunal can always be taken on appeal or on review by a party who's unhappy. Secondly, it has to explain its reasons for doing so. It cannot hear a case in the background. It has to explain and give reasons for its decision. It has to make its case publicly. Thirdly, tribunals sit in panels of three, and we vote on the thing. Each person has an equal vote on that. So I think that is, you know, you could never completely eradicate corruption from any system, but I think there are enough checks and balances within that system to remove the possibility or corruption. People know that. The next question was around the issues of collusion, and I'm not sure if I understood the question correctly, but in terms of the invoicing systems like that, that would be something specifically that is dealt with by the competition authority or all under I. Essentially, we use the term collusion, we talk about collusion between competing firms and setting prices or dividing markets or tendering. So it may be something that has been dealt with by our authorities or something that falls within our particular remit. In terms of foreign cartel, if a foreign cartel has an effect on the Australian economy, it is subject to us, and the case of Anzac was a case that points all those firms were foreign, and we have jurisdiction over them. So as long as there's an economic effect in South Africa, we have jurisdiction. no see that happening in South Africa. If all the infections started flooding into our civil courts, we would find that courts would start damping dominant standards to the detriment of our public administrative system. So, although it may be an answer to a practical civil claim, if we follow the US example, it may be quite some incredible damages because courts would start thinking, well, we're not really regretting the service behavior. This is a bunch of people who are on the make that trying to make credible damages out of the situation as it happens in the US. So, it's an idea, but I would be cautious about that idea. The issue of the appointment of members and how they get appointed. The members are appointed by the president on the advice of the trade industry. What happens is part of the trading industry has called for people to apply. The act is basically brief on qualifications, suitable qualifications in law, economics, and public administration can apply and the DEI then kind of the vetting process and appoint people. It doesn't agree to everybody who meets that particular test and there's also money to be set up in citizens. On the issue of our impact and how we are trying to keep up the impact that we made on the poor and the impact that we made on the public, I can answer both at the same time. One of the points that we've been trying to do is to publicize our activities as much as possible to get to the audience, to get to the wider audience and as the commission. I think that's been very, very successful. I sometimes think we've got more publicity than some other institutions are doing, also being very important to work. So I think we've had our fair share of that. But one of the things that we've done, for instance, in these consent orders where there have been coming forward for a fine, is we've allowed people from the public to make representation. It's been very, very powerful. And so people have come from different organisations, trade unions have come along and said, people have come from civil society, people have come from farmers associations. And interestingly enough, one of the farmers associations came to the hearing where Sattel was fined for cartel in the fertilizer industry, and now decided to declare it was going to proceed with a civil claim. And during the course of that proceeding, it was actually discussed with them, were they going to take this further, and they said, we would explore that. I think that having them at that proceeding made that industry association think about that issue and take up that issue. So I think it has had an impact on people. And the other question is, what is the impact on poorer people of that activity? Well, fundamentally, I think if a competition enforcement system is working properly, then we are lowering prices and creating greater choice. And then poorer people, in the sense of, are paying less, lower prices and getting more choice, there's an impact on them every day, whether the commodity is a food commodity, it might be right upstream at a chemical level, which impacts on them later. If we are putting more money into possibly poor food system working properly, then we are doing the same. That's a very, very difficult thing to measure in totality, because we not only have to look at the cases we've done, but the cases we might have had to deal with if we didn't have that system. It's not so much, not only the people who broke the law and got caught, it leads to the other question. Is the system seem to be working? And are the other people who might say, well, I might have thought of speaking to my competitors about fixing the price. I've now seen what happened to those other people. I won't do that again. And I think the system is being seen very at a very public level to have peace and to be working. And I think the other damage that we haven't talked about today, which is very, very important, is reputational damage from the firms. Firms going before the competition tribunal do not have a happy time. CEOs that appear before my predecessor David Burton, we are subject to questions from him, do not have a happy morning. And there was a lot of publicity attached to that as well. When the case ran against one of the bread companies, which the commission is running, and it is currently before us, on the first 2 days of that proceeding, both SABC and ETV had their cameras there on prime time television every night. That particular company's brand was seen up there in public being charged with allegations of price collusion. And the reputational damage to a firm going through that must be considerable. And I think there must be firms who are saying, not only the question that we have.
question on the volunteers.
Sorry, we were questioned about what types of positions have been imposed upon virtue. The commission manual reported on page 28 to 29 has given a whole list of examples, but just in general terms, they've either been what we call positions to address the competition problem, and they've sometimes been, you know, firms, competitors of emerging firms, they might not get a supply contract. We ordered the firms to enter into supply contracts with them. Sometimes they're involved in public interest, for instance, in employment. Quite recently, we dealt with something in the ship repair industry, and we set a minimum number of people who could be retrenched as a result of that merger. We sometimes in employment require those results of the competition that we done to try and address the. Other times we also have what are called structural remedies, which is involved in a divestiture of a particular division. In most cases, our experience has been that conditions have been adhered to, or we do conditions that we think that people out in the market can at least monitor rather than relying on the authority. I recall in one case at least where we ordered the divestiture hasn't been done in time, but it's since been done in time, right? It has since been done. But otherwise, our general impression is that the conditions are being adhered to. If they're not adhered to, there is a remedy being applied on the firm. And we also are enlarged to actually unwind the merger. So there is very powerful intent for the firm to actually obey the conditions.
Yes,
Mr.
Honourable Members,
I have an opportunity just to ask the members of the Council to follow up.
I understand that would be the first step, and of course we hope everyone's question was answered, but are there any follow-ups in this area? If there, yes, Honourable Ambrosini.
The question, which I'm not sure whether it's to answer to the tribunal or to the commission or to the committee yet, but as we have gone through this journey of induction and trading industry, and we many of us get more familiar with various aspects of the industry across the, especially in terms of public enterprise. So we constantly stumble on monopolistic or oligopolistic situations which are entrenched in legislation, shielded in legislation, and somehow taken out of the scope of authority of the competition authority. Now, I, for one, I was trying to find a study on the anti-competitive, on the statement of anti-competitive economic environment in South Africa. I couldn't find it. Now, the competition authority has the skill, and it's a very difficult skill to acquire. Talk about the lawyers, the economists. But its scope of authority is limited by the boundaries of that which is entrenched in legislation. But we as lawmakers, purported to be lawmakers, ought to apply our mind to revisit all those situations. And I was wondering whether there is a scope of authority within this committee to request the authority to conduct a study of the entire landscape of South African trade, industry, commerce, and to see how many of these anti-competitive practices have been entrenched in legislation, which we ought to revisit, that we can begin getting the ball rolling against the threshold of an ideal Parisian economic world where everything is fully optimized. Obviously, there are situations where it's not possible. I think about telecommunication, post office, Transnet, and it goes on and on and on. And we don't have either a single document which identifies all this reality or a document which assesses the economic cost of this reality. Many of them come from the pre-1994 environment, and they're part of an entrenched way of doing business, a culture of doing business. I think it would be very valuable for us, Madam Chair, to acquire this type of understanding of what is the cost of carrying on this reality to the country and to the economy.
Thank you very much. I also think the point I made before I left is that some of the questions would involve the Commission as well and we would respond to that as well. But just a few issues. I had hoped that the issues around dormant matters would have been raised. In the annual report, the issue of dormant matters was referred to. Have rules to close such dormant matters been established yet? And if yes, yes, what are the rules? And secondly, is there a maximum time period within which a matter must be heard, given what has already been referred to in the report itself as in external constraints and so on? There are a couple of other issues that have come up which we may refer to you in writing and get response back to you in writing after the content specialist has seen whether or not you have covered all of those areas. Some of them, in fact, refer to staff matters as well, complements of staff, vacancies, and that kind of thing. But we'll leave that for the moment. And if you could respond to that one, I think there was probably just one other question mark around that one. I think broadly you referred to how the budget was determined, or was rather a broad reference. But the more you speak about the complexities of determining that budget are very, very difficult because you have no idea from the tribunal side what you're getting. So if you could look at that and just share with us how you would determine that and how you measure your efficiency in this particular regard. And then you rely only on the media, as it were, in these public hearings to make the public aware of yourself, or do you have other measures that you use to determine how well the general public are aware of your work? If we could try and get those responses and close off in the next 10 minutes, please.
No further procedural steps. As far as we're concerned, we don't have to take any further procedural steps. That is their problem. We don't see it as our job, once the public, as it were, protects the competition, take no further action to activate those people. In fact, if we did, we would get ourselves into trouble because we'd see the adjudicator not being decided. In terms of when you can bring a case, the act says you must bring that case within 3 years of the practice having ended. But even if a person has brought a complaint within the right time, if they choose not to proceed with the matter, that is their problem. It is the respondent has the right under our system to ask the matter to, if they've incurred any costs, for us to set the matter down to certain costs. And if both are passive and safe, it's simply an entry into our books and we don't really have to worry about as far as that's concerned. Just as far as our budget is concerned, as I mentioned, most of our budget is on salaries, and because we're a reactive organisation, not sure if the Commission is going to bring up that case is going to last 3 weeks or settle with the consent order. What we've done is to try and minimise our largest expense, which would be tribunal members' salaries. The way of trying to minimise it is not to have all 11 members appointed on a full-time basis. By having them on a part-time basis, we are able to be, we only pay them then for when we need it, so we minimise the budget slightly. We can't always get the calculation of what we might need and what we use absolutely perfectly. We see in the
points on the Honourable Andrew Senior's point. I think there's a very valuable point that has been made, which is to say that, you know, it's not the competition authorities by themselves or alone that are going to result in higher levels of competitiveness in this economy. I mean, I think the one thing, it's a trite point, but it's not the competition authorities that are responsible for competition in this economy. It's private firms that are responsible for it. I mean, that's the bottom line. Private firms need to be competing with each other, and that's when competition occurs. I certainly don't see the Competition Commission as being the agency responsible for higher levels of competition. I often get people asking me a question like, oh, right, who are you going to take on next? You know, as though the Commission kind of gets up one morning and decides who we're going to take on. This is not how the system works. As the Honourable Abyssinia said, we are creatures of statute. We can only do what the law allows us to do. We can't do anything beyond that. And there's a whole range of other things that needs to occur in the economy and markets to ensure that there are higher levels of competition. And if you understand, for example, as has been well canvassed in this meeting, the kind of legal nature of proceedings, the standards of proof we have to meet, these are very difficult things. You need very smart people. You need to strategize around them to overcome them. And we have in South Africa a kind of rights-based legal culture that gives everybody rights to kind of challenge judicial, quasi judicial decisions like ours, which means that you can't overcome that. People do have constitutional rights to pursue matters. All of this doesn't mean that we need to become kind of bureaucratic organizations that just stick to kind of letters of the law. Indeed, I would like to believe that we strategic in the way we go about dealing with some of these issues in order to overcome the very kind of issues that we've identified here. So the question then is, what is the role of Parliament? How can we kind of, what role beyond the Commission can other sectors, in particular other parts of society or other institutions in society, in particular Parliament, can do? And I think this point has been made last night and again in various ways together today, is that we need to kind of look at, just to say before that, in some ways the Commission, as been said by somebody, has become like victims of its own success. The more we do, the more we produce, the more we use, the more people expect us to do things. So we're getting a lot of things thrown at us that are not entirely things that we have the ability to do in terms of our legal mandate. And I think that's an important thing for a body like this to understand. What is the nature of this tool? If you'd be using that toolbox analogy, what is the nature of this tool and what can it achieve? And what other complementary things need to occur to strengthen the efforts of the competition authorities? And just at the top of my head, a few things come in mind, which some of which we've spoken about earlier, and I won't say much about the complementarity of consumer protection law to competition law. That's an important thing that I think is within the realm of this structure to kind of advance and push. There are other things that businesses can do out there that kind of fall broadly under the topic of corporate governance, which is, you know, all the policy issues that lead to the better governance of how businesses are run is something that I think a committee like this could have its say over, various things that come to you or under general. You know, here I mentioned yesterday about the responsibilities of boards, the oversight function of boards of directors, for example, of companies. And this is some of these things have come to the committee like this in terms of the Companies Act. But as also has been pointed out, I think the most important thing for us is to pay particular attention to the regulated sector, to the regulated markets in order to ensure that those markets, that regulations governing those markets are at least not anti-competitive. Because often we have that situation where private players, private parties come to us and use some interaction they've had with another government department as an excuse for them to continue anti-competitive behavior. We have this, in, for example, in the milk case, but this is a whole old historical thing that occurred in the olden days. Milk was regulated, when it was deregulated, on the side the industry spoke to the DTI, they came up with some arrangement, and the industry thinks that that is now something they could continue with. We have this in healthcare, where we're following our finding on tariff setting by the BHF and the Hospital Association. They are, you know, there isn't, the Department of Health is not clear about how to go about determining these tariffs, because they're used to doing it in a way where they say the industry needs to go and determine it and you adopt what you do. We've seen this again with the CASA issue right now. And I think the general principle there is we, of course, you know, where there's a regulated sector and a law governing that sector, that's a law that we, you know, we can't oppose. We don't have the power to change laws. We don't make laws. The Parliament makes laws. The point is for those laws to be constructed in a way that's not anti-competitive. And you know, one of the difficulties we now are having as well is, say, with ICASA and other regulators, is that we are being called upon often to by other regulators saying that the industry does not want to talk to us because they're afraid that they will be breaking competition law by getting together and talking to us. This is a very current topic, you know, dealing with the CASA issue and the healthcare issue. And in petrochemicals, when there was, for example, a shortage of fuel in the OR Tambo Airport, and Mineral and Energy wanted to get, the Department of Mineral and Energy wanted to get all the players together, they refused to come to them because they said that, you know, they're going to run foul of competition law. And it's a bit of a kind of red herring from the side of industry, because the bottom line here is any public agency that takes the lead in and runs a process, a regulation process, is not something we have jurisdiction over, but any group of private parties that do so is a problem. So, I don't know if this is clear, but to give you an example of ICASA, there's a question about whether in setting this interim rate of interconnection fee, on the methodology to use this, the methodology to do this. And there's a lot of hand-wringing about, yes, but how can we meet together in order to determine this price without breaking competition law? And the point we make is that you are not meeting together, you shouldn't be meeting together, you should be meeting under the auspices of the regulator. The regulator must take the lead and must design the process in a way that's not anti-competitive. But if we leave it to you to do by yourself, then of course you're going to be suspicious that doing it by yourself, you are likely to come up with some sort of anti-competitive solution.
Thank you very much. I'm just listening to one of your phrases. That we need to avoid writing laws or whatever, and actually laws to be constructed in a way that is not anti-competitive. Are there some laws that are fall into that category?
There are some practices. There might well be laws that I'm not aware of, but the milk case is a case in point. The way in which tariffs in the healthcare sector is a case in point. Some of the petrochemical companies and their
asked, do we know reason what informed that particular approach or tariff and so on? But I do see the Honourable Minister Rana wants to comment on something, but I also know the Shepherds of the Tribunal wants to just complete something.
Right.
So why don't you do that?
I was asked what members of could do to complement our work for me in the broader constituency. I think the issues of education getting out is always a good message, but I think trying to get people involved in quite a useful way in cases is an important thing. For instance, if we have a merger of two furniture companies, which we've had in the past, and you've got people in the community for whom the choice of furniture stores or the two firms involved in the merger, it'd be very useful to have their voice coming to us saying, you know, those two guys are the only people that we can go to, and don't listen to their story that we've got so many alternatives, because the alternatives are wrong for that reason. We don't have enough of that voice coming before us. It is, of course, complicated to how we, sitting in Pretoria, dealing with merger, communicate with people out in the areas where they are, and I think that's one thing that we don't have enough of that, as it were, grassroots voice, which is very useful. You never know what actually is going on in a particular situation until you hear from people themselves on the ground what's going on. Secondly, we've asked because of practices. I think particularly in small business, if people are aware of changing business practices, they're perceived they will comply and that they will adopt and serve. We need information that is useful. And people can come up and say, well, you and X company have supplied on this basis. Now all of a sudden, because a competitor went on the market, it's changed the terms of supply and very unfavorable. So those are useful indications to us about what's going on there. But the important thing is that people need to be the detectors of the agencies on the ground. It doesn't help us for people to say, I went to ShopRite, checked it yesterday, and the paper price has gone up, I'm bringing complaints. Leave you information that is useful to the authorities that they can act on. In other words, we need to not just have the manifestations of it, but if people out there can be communicating, have you got something useful? Is there noise going on that you're aware of that I know Pretoria, tell Pretoria about that? That's the kind of message to try and get out there.
Right. We're really going to have to close off the session. So we'll certainly put the question or comment from Honourable Nicolana on the table. But it's now close on top park. We have another matter to deal with in the next 10 minutes. So over to you, Honourable Nchikalana.
Yeah, that's it. No mind the comment, have any questions. If you look at the strategic priority of the commission in particular, vis-à-vis the demonstrable, you know, achievements of the authority in combination. I feel strongly that once again we need to just ensure that we express ourselves to whatever appropriate means under leadership regarding the expected extra load given the amendment. One has observed, as I say, as long as they know what the escalation of work, which is also shown in the report, as to why there's a deficit. And precisely, I think that, you know, whilst it may be within the ambit of the competition authorities to go and lobby, negotiate within CTI and Treasury around ensuring that the deficit is reduced, I also maintain that it's an incumbent on us to reinforce that, you know, there are appropriate because at the end of the day, there could be a risk of saying that the competition authorities are not effective enough once they've been given more power, so that it's actually due to the deficit. On the other hand, the very competition authorities have been generating income about 3-4 times. That's my humble opinion. Thank you.
Right, now, what I'm going to propose to the Commission and the Tribunal is I do see
some members of your commission and the tribunal here, and certainly for people like the Kennedy and Courtney and the Commissioner, Kennedy and Courtney Bonatella, Commissioner, is it? Meeting today, I'm not sure, and I'm not sure who Simon Roberts is. He's not here, this is perfect. So, certainly be aware of all the team being here, and I would appreciate everyone's name just on a sheet of paper for our benefit. We also have a number of other questions and clarifications that we seek, and time does not allow them at this meeting. But what we will do is keep them in writing. We do have them to ourselves, but obviously we want to send an official letter to you, which will reach you tomorrow in this regard, and indicating the questions that have not really been covered during this particular session as such. Some of them, of course, we have since located in the various and the two different respective annual reports. But on behalf of the committee, for the earlier committee, we would certainly like to thank the chairman of the county hall, Mr. Norman Manoyan. We would also like to thank the, commissioner, is it? Not chief commissioner, but Commissioner Rumboon, for your presence here this morning, and for sharing with us the, what you're doing, what your mandate is, how you're carrying it out. And we will try to look at it and evaluate some of the responses we've received from you with the assistance of our own staff. And I think some of these suggestions we do make when it comes out in the annual report, you've heard a couple here already, we hope they'll be constructive and actually underpin your efforts to perform even better in the following financial year itself. But thank you very much for your time, your patience, and your participation here this morning. Thank you. On the committee side, I think that all of us do have the content specialist analysis and so on. Am I correct? Yes. Well, I'm sure it's still somewhere here then, and you will have that as well. Do you have an honorable copy? That's just honorable embassy that may not have it. And what we do have to do, and we'll ask the content specialist just to go through some of the queries and comments we had, and what hasn't been covered will simply come out of here and go back to the respective authorities. We will ask the, you are going to handle something else with the bilateral meeting, somebody else as well, the time movers. And we would obviously ask the member to come forward from either VA or Coast to work in on this, to check the final sections of paper. And also one of our own, and I'm not going to be here, and look is under a lot of pressure, but perhaps together with Honourable Jikalaka and with together, you may be able just to check the final letter, which will be compiled after. In other words, it will certainly check against what we have asked. And anything outstanding will be sent requesting a response in writing. I hope I've made myself clear. We're not adding new issues here. It is simply what we haven't had time to request. So,
that
issue, we said it may be preferable for us to engage. about performing, even if we're not here in Parliament, as to what your activities are. Sometimes committee members may be able to attend some of these activities. Thank you very much, all of you.
Parliament has in many ways
There are two primary mechanisms the Parliament has for engaging international relations. The first is this committee system, the Portfolio Select Committee. And the purpose of the committee, as you are well aware of, is to oversee the executive action on legislation, ratifying agreements with constitutional provisions 231. And it is seen as the traditional mechanism for engaging international relations. And the traditional approach to international participation is the approach we find internationally throughout the world. But more recently, and this is in the past 10 to 15 years, we have seen a parallel mechanism referred to generally as parliamentary diplomacy. And parliamentary diplomacy are all the activities and engagements that Parliament undertakes at an international level. Parliament established at the end of 2006 a parliamentary group on international relations, and this group is currently headed by the House Chairperson for International Relations, Honourable Ramon. The purpose of the PGIR is to oversee bilateral and multilateral relations. And bilateral relations, for example, will be an agreement with the Chinese People's Congress, which they have actually signed, talking about strengthening relations between our parliament and the Chinese People's Congress. Multilateral relations will involve our engagement in organizations such as the Interparliamentary Union. And for purposes of this committee, the South African EU Interparliamentary Committee, as well as the African Caribbean Pacific European Union Joint Parliamentary Assembly. So those are the two systems that we have in place at the moment. We are going to focus on the second system, which is the parliamentary diplomacy component, and that is regarded as a parallel, non-traditional approach to international relations. But there are four primary areas that parliamentary diplomacy covers, ranging from election observer missions to participation in multilateral forums. And we will focus on point number four, which is the multilateral forum. There are seven multilateral bodies that Parliament currently engages with. The two most important ones for purposes of this committee is the African Caribbean Pacific EU Joint Parliamentary Assembly, which is highlighted in green, and the South African European Union Parliamentary meetings. Those are the two most important for purposes of this committee and for purposes of engaging with the inter-European counterparts. There's a long history of engagement with the European Parliament, which I'm quickly going to go through, starting pre-94, being formalized by our first speaker of the National Assembly, Dr. Jean Wala. There was a bit of a lull in the relationship between our Parliament and theirs in the late 90s and early 2000s, until very recently when the Trade Development and Cooperation Agreement, which is a bilateral agreement between South Africa and the European Union, was signed. And then the Cotonou Partnership Agreement, which is an agreement between all of the African Caribbean and Pacific states on the one hand and the European Union on the other, was also signed. Now, the EDCA, the Trade Development and Cooperation Agreement, has been signed and ratified. The Cotonou Partnership Agreement has not been ratified. It was signed in 2000. And amongst the documents that were given to you today, there is an explanation from the Department of International Relations and Cooperation as to why that has not been ratified. Primarily it's because of technical reasons. Then you have a declaration which was signed between our parliament and the European Parliament, and a copy of that has also been made available. It has also not been submitted by the National Assembly, but has been signed as the start of the in February 2000. So that's something that we probably need to pay attention to. And then finally, very, very importantly, Parliament sent two observers to attend the South Africa EU Summit, which took place last month. Now, the SAEU Summit is a summit of heads of state. The president, or seven ministers from the South African side, meet with the European counterpart. But for the very, very first time, Parliament sent two members of Parliament to observe the proceedings of the SAEU Summit. The Sergeant is one of them, and Honourable Nancy from the Cook things that we engage with the EU through are, the first one is the ACP EU Joint Parliamentary Assembly. The Cotonou Agreement, which I referred to earlier, is the legal basis for engaging with the EU in that context. The Cotonou Agreement, as I mentioned, has been signed but not ratified. It is four times again headed by Honorable Marandela plus two MPs. And the primary focus there is on the Economic Partnership Agreement, which I'm sure you're very familiar with, and also one of the political developments in the ACP and EU countries. The second mechanism which we use is the South Africa EU Parliamentary Meeting, and I would argue that this is the more important parliamentary mechanism for engaging with the EU. It's headed by seven MPs, and the delegation yet to be, full delegation yet to be determined. But the primary focus there is to strengthen the relations between our respective parliaments and to monitor various political and economic developments in respect of our region. Another observation is that parliament engagement with the EU is reflective of an independent parliament. We do as an institution see ourselves separately from the executive. At the same time, the independence is exerted very carefully, and also it is exerted in the context of South Africa's national foreign policy objectives and is largely focused at the parliament to the diplomacy level. One of the major challenges is that there has been very little substantive engagement on some of the fundamental issues due to exclusion of the White Hand, but also due to parliamentary deference to the executive on the other. Parliament has really taken a back seat when it comes to international engagement. And unfortunately, our members of Parliament have not fully engaged with the issues in a very, very serious manner. We have seen trends which suggest that this is going to change. And we are hoping that engagement such as this will be the start of the change we hope to implement as an international relations conference. Finally, the institution to attend the SAEU summit that I referred to earlier on is an indication of this change, is an indication that Parliament wants to play a more important, positive, and substantive role in international relations, and we hope to see more of this in the future. And my final slide, which are some recommendations, is that the major problem I would like to put forward is that Parliament lacks the necessary political will to challenge its marginalization from the foreign policy development process. It really starts with members of Parliament deciding that Parliament is going to take an active role in international participation, and that we are rightfully going to claim our constitutional mandate, our constitutional power to engage on international issues. That's where it essentially starts. Secondly, parliamentary diplomacy activities that we currently engage in need to be reevaluated and consolidated. We are, in my opinion, engaging in far too many multilateral institutions, and there are some institutions that don't necessarily provide a substantial benefit for those institutions. The Commonwealth Parliamentary Association is one of those, in my opinion. The Association of Senators and Shura is another. Many have argued that these organizations are seen as political tourism, that members go there, don't necessarily engage with issues. And the cost benefit analysis reveals that the benefits for Parliament are very minimal compared to the kind of costs that we incur. So a revaluation consolidation at some level. Thirdly, we have to develop mechanisms to facilitate public participation in the foreign policy process. This is an area that I am particularly passionate about and want to strongly advocate for. I believe that it is imperative for the voices of ordinary South Africans to be heard at negotiation tables in Geneva and in New York. We must find mechanisms to ensure that people's voices are heard at those international levels. And for many years, the executive has really dominated foreign policy decision making. It makes decisions. finally, the international relations section, which is the administrative arm of parliament, the section that I work for, needs to be strengthened. We do need much more capacity, particularly human people, to fully support members of parliament in their work. And just on a final note, I sincerely thank the chair for the opportunity to present to the committee. I think it's an important step in the right direction, and I trust that members of parliament will engage with this document. I've also included in the list of documents a draft paper which I wrote for the Journal of Legislative Studies. The paper has a much more in-depth analysis and assessment of parliament's disclosure. A few things have changed since then, but it provides me with a fairly decent underlying basis for which to engage on this issue. And I'm happy to take any questions. Thank you very much.
And just so we received two handouts and then draft reports. My understanding that the Cotonou Agreement was the first in the end of 2007, when it had been replaced by EPA. And maybe the last area is during the squeeze in time. See, it might be helpful that really, at some stage, we will really interact with the other countries that we use in the national relations.
particularly PDA are aware, just to get a broad sense as to what a Parliament program is on international issues. I use the term broadly, international issues, but it could be the parliamentary diplomacy, it could be international trade, it could be a few other things, peacekeeping, less travel, missions and stuff. Thanks.
Yes, just before you finish on that one, we must underpin that more for not to honor that ourselves is now the resolution 12 after the application. So, we have to close that. For those of you who are sorry, I'm so sorry, I'm not going to be a chair, but I'm going to be a second as well.
Thank you, Chairperson. Mr. Arnold has referred to a term which I've been on smart and that is return on investment. And they said they have a very low return on investment in terms of certain of the expenditure that we've run up in the past. My question is when or where will we have an opportunity to identify what we want out of this? Where can we put specific goals? Achievements, what we want to learn from this. And can I just add that in many other fields, we contain more enterprises than I want. I've been getting a few institutions, and I can go and learn from others, and others can learn from us. When it comes to the parliament in the country, they've got their own parliament. So, fortunately or unfortunately, you can only learn from the experience of other countries. But if we could break that down, what specifically do we want to experience? What do we want to learn? What are we concerned about in our operations here? And may it be possible that others have got solutions to those concerns, good practices, etc. When and where are we going to identify that?
on proliferation of nuclear
would be looking at those agreements to determine what the best way forward would be in terms of partners. We are still able to participate fully in the African Caribbean Pacific EU meeting. And last week I was in Brussels with Honorable Manamela and his delegation, and we were fully able to participate. So they have not stopped us from participating in these forums. I spoke earlier on to the chief negotiator, Zeyra Karim, and earlier on today I spoke to our colleagues at the Department of International Relations and Cooperation. They have indicated that the COSLO process came to a bit of its fall when the change in department took place and the change in administration took place very recently, and that they are going to ignite the COSLO issue in the next couple of months. Our ambassador in Brussels thinks it's going to be done before November, so hopefully this is something that will happen in the next few months. At the moment, though, they've assured us that it's not such an urgent or same issue. The modification of continental, it will happen in the next few months. You also mentioned the interaction with other committees in Central Dilemma, and I think that's pretty much welcome. The first asked about which systems are in place to deal with the issues. The two systems which you currently have, the committee system and the committee, which is the traditional system, and then the parliamentary group on international relations. Unfortunately, those systems work parallel to each other and they haven't yet worked jointly together. And one of the proposals and recommendations I'm making is that there is closer cooperation and interaction from the PGR and the committee. Now, the chairperson of the PGIR, which is Honorable Wilson, has shown an interest in working very closely with committees and she's already taken action in that regard. So the best way to engage, I think, would be for the chair of this committee to speak directly to Ms. Wilson and to set up some sort of mechanism for closer engagement. I think that would be the best way forward there. You also asked to talk about the members of our delegation. Unfortunately, we are dependent on political parties to make those nominations. We have received some nominations, for example, I think know who the political parties are that are at the the African National Congress has provided us with the names of Ms. Fuzz and Honorable Nancy, but there are four. The determination is essentially made by a collective committee which is headed by the chief whips of the various parties together with the chairperson of the half-chairperson of the International Relations of Qualifying. So essentially taken at a political level and we simply implement those decisions. So that's where the process is currently stuck. At that political level, and I think that needs to be pushed out. So we don't have a full list of delegates for the SAE, unfortunately. And then, on the whole, kind of best thing, the question about what kind of opportunities can you identify for out of this process, I think that's an essential question. One of the things I have done is a very comparative analysis between Parliament of South Africa, the US Congress. I've also looked at the Brazilian Parliament, Indian Parliament, Canadian Parliament, and Tanzanian
seen such a great deal of very attitude. Even as we sit here now, we learn things about the Eurogo bit, you know, and so on and so forth. And it may be that the intention is there, but we need some of these systems and procedures in place. And yet, in so many ways, we're not that taking the decision. So, obviously, I will list the sound that's important in his own way from his position. But I'm saying that I do think whoever is parliamentarily responsible, in other words, in this case, the Honourable Robert Oliphant, who's the House Chairperson, we need to ask her if we can engage this minister. And as we know, there's multi-party, and yet some parties, perhaps some of them, participating actively in others, and yet they are mental responses and how does this work. So I do know one thing, that it comes under joint rules, if I'm not mistaken, which I'm not sure that's strange, you know, in that particular respect. But because time is beginning to go to every aspect, well, I hope we can get this response, look at what we want to propose to get together, share through, and secondly, set aside the time when we come back up, we're really asking Andre to say, look, can we have some 4 slots, 1 hour where we can ask someone to not simply someone from administration with due respect, but someone, if you like, with the political authority in terms of parliament or people's office to come back and to. And so I hope that's acceptable. We'll certainly ask the office to respond as far as we can, and then let's take it forward later. Yes, I'm all correct.
Just from my side as well, I think it will be especially where our communication board, our good interested leadership, and it's incredibly short notice. I mean, we have done our program with the committee, and I'm sure the committee was not aware of it. So obviously, much more notice. I think it will obviously give us the opportunity to engage with our political parties. Because I mean, if our political party has not responded, it is not acceptable to me either. And I think there is something from this committee that maybe the dynamics is different in this committee than many others. So that we can also do something. Because I mean, I don't believe that we are just here for filling out the seat.
Sure.
You know, I think we've been very, very constructive as a multi-party committee, really. So if we can have that information, and I will certainly follow up after the fact that we've already said that it's our chief group to say, you know, this is communicated with us, why have we not responded? I don't know whether I'll be on the red carpet.
Look, in all fairness, I think the DA is one of the parties that has been responded. Yeah. But I think as a member of the administration, Honourable Mr. Armour, I didn't want to start giving all specifics about the party. But the fact that is look for today has been told me about it, Honourable Mr. If they need things no more before I do, so you know, I know he knows about it, you know, and I think. But that's why I think what Mr. Armand is trying to avoid himself implicating a particular political party who hasn't responded. Suffice to say, all of the members of political parties do know about it. They have been invited to meetings. That's what I do know. And some may not have responded with a name because perhaps they're consulting within their ranks. But I think they. Of the delegation of 5, it's 1 or 2 that are not on board.
Yeah. Oh. Out of the delegation of 8,
yes.
We have 3 names. 5 are
seven. Right. And are they all from then the other parties?
Right.
We have a confirmation of the going, but we don't have the name. Right. Don't have that. Yeah. And I know that we are anxious to get them to use the Schengen visa issue, which needs. 3 days before the 18th. the IFC or the COPE or the DA or any other member, so that that's a fact of a member know what I'm actually saying. Why don't you approach your chief and find out what proof is on what he's saying? Because I think that's where we are. I personally can't do it because not I didn't put together the delegation as such. So I think you've given us what you can, but we are going to call you back and at the Manco gate try and find an hour slot for us certainly to report back here, but also to try and get further information. But to me, can you hold on 1 minute? It's literally 1 minute, because I've even got a taxi to get. So I have before me something here. It's a very small thing, which you've got. Can you see it there? It says here, a draft report. We say, following a presentation, we don't have a problem with that paragraph. We undertake to establish, look, this comes from our strategic report anyway, a close working relationship, etc. I don't think anyone has a problem with number one. I'm looking at everyone. Two,
actually, whether we have a copy, just so that we be careful whether we want to say establish slash improve, and just putting it across the challenge. Because sometimes you find that some of these things are there, but they are moving at the same
time. Okay, I'm going to see. In other words, they may well be established, they may be strengthening.
Okay.
A close working relationship will also be established, and if already established, strengthened. An example. Okay? And that's the group we're talking about all the time as well, the group there. Trade industry will work with other committees again. I think that's what, again, coming out of stress, our stress working. That's the fourth one, proposing something else. Recommended, obviously, when anything is recommended, we stop. The chairperson of Parliament of South Africa European Union delegation. The chairperson of Parliament of South Africa European Union delegation. Who's that? That one you can see, we haven't been talking. I wasn't sure if this was the honourable one. Okay, sorry about that. To fast track the approval of the joint declaration on the further strengthening of interparliamentary relations and political dialogue between the delegations of the Parliament of the Republic of South Africa and the European Parliament. In other words, that's definitely established, am I right? And reviewing what the Honourable Mabaso is saying, strengthening. Is that right, Honourable Mabaso? Yes.
Madam Chair, the specific point is about this joint declaration that has been signed, that's point four. That's the joint declaration that has been signed, but not ratified by Parliament.
department, and I think we need to put this as a challenge. If there's more than not one department involved in these issues, how do we make sure we expedite this? So we definitely going to need to work together with International, and if this was signed on our behalf in Cape Town, it meant that a joint committee, we're not that joint committee, a committee of all political parties were there. So I would ask your political parties, all of you are sitting here from three others and four political parties, do they know anything about this? So that you can be briefed also politically. And then nevertheless, the last one, the portfolio, will work with other committees to determine the most appropriate allocation of resources to strengthen Parliament's international relations agenda, as well as to provide the necessary political guidance. This is asking for three critical issues. No one has a problem, I take it, with working with other committees here and strengthening it. Am I right on that one? The second thing is, no one has a problem in saying we need to have property resources. The third one, I'm not going to say you have a problem. I need to know if you have any comments on that third issue. Thank you, Honourable Minister. Okay, let's just get that third one that I mentioned. Are there any, you know, the one that refers to the joint declaration? Yes, anyone wants to comment on that? Honourable Nicolana?
In 4 and 5, why don't you change the comment to agree to what it's asked, who are committing to that? And the last point, second line from the bottom, the use of necessary political guidance. That's fine.
I think
that would be a better idea, because I know the pivotal committee in Parliament on international trade is at an international relations. and so forth, and to be well understood.
I hope that that properly captures the idea. And then the final thing was an addition from one of the
investors. It still uses my point that I want to be able to identify some outputs as to this. You know, what do we want to gain from this? And I've put it here as an amendment, but perhaps before we start talking about the wording of it, you could just be able to
in other words, we have different groups going over. As our own committee, we know we would have to motivate one to go. You know, we motivate him to go on this kind of trip to achieve that. If we go for PMID or PGIR on a particular issue, what do we expect? What are our expected outputs? You know, or is it simply as a parliamentary group, our whole role is to establish a parliamentary relations in its broadest ambit and understanding, because our particular parliament is not like the A, like the American one, and it's not like the C, we were told it's more a parliament of influence. All right, so you can see we're going to be losing some people. And so can we, in principle, it's being proposed, in principle, can we adopt with some change?
Indeed.
We might be able to cope adequately with all the ramifications that arise. Right. So we're just coming.
anyone else who feels they have the time
task is being corrected. You know, to ensure that the cause of the committee decision that was proposed by the Honourable Oyonye was in it. Is that all right? And if that then goes wrong, I hope I'm quite clear on that. So we are putting two people together to ensure through the committee secretary that this is done. Right, is that agreed? And then we don't believe that there is anything happening on Tuesday the 13th, and so that if indeed the speaker does not schedule anything because we haven't got anything but we were told not to use that day, will the task team utilize that day for their work if necessary?
Definitely.
So that we meet at 9 o'clock on, at 9:30 on Wednesday the 14th. Well, is there? This Friday. Right. On Friday the 9th of October, I will not be here, and I would like to propose, but obviously there may be a difference of opinion, that with of the committee chairs that committee meeting on Friday the 9th at 8:30. Are there any objections?
No, I agree.
And we... And the extra person is the NEX. We've lost the day, so we haven't put the NEX there. So it's Kula and the NEX. Kula and the NEX. The sooner you get here, the sooner the meeting will start. The meeting is going to start with or without the forum. Yes, E249. With, but we hope people will be here as soon as possible. 8:30 to 12:00. Thank you very much for your sterling work, all of you. And also, welcome back, Honourable Aliania Bassini. We missed your input over in one or two meetings, which we thought was really helpful as you've been here. You are as prolific a writer as Honourable Nicolana. And Honourable Benjamin is coming up in closer. Thank you very much.
So,
shortlisting for position of board members on Wednesday.